Members, I'll call this conference committee to order. I'm going to try to move as quickly as I can today because I know there are some pressing things that are scheduled, particularly among our Senate Republicans. So we're going to try to be as efficient as we can today. And by the way, congratulations, members. We elected regents today. It took us a long time this session, but I think we elected a good group of folks. So today, what I want to do is really a repeat of what we did a couple of days ago, but with different issues. We want to review House provisions that are related to sexual assault statutes, gender-based violence prevention, police professional development, and we'll start off by hearing from the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Members, this is our side of the table's way of laying before the conference committee issues that hopefully we'll be making decisions and voting on sometime soon. And it really does reflect, I would find, you know, a serious, quite frankly, muscular approach to responding to Minnesota's desire for change and how we do public safety. Of course, Mr. Chair, we're still waiting for fiscal conference committee targets from our leadership, and that should happen like any minute now, I think, yeah. Right? Yeah. And so I do want to acknowledge that the Senate Chair has expressed concern that the budget target that the Senate carries into this conference is not adequate enough to meet our constitutional obligation. I think the House bill does meet those. But I hope with that common desire that both sides here can agree to keep moving our leaders to get a target for this conference committee, not only as soon as possible, but one that actually works well for state government. I did have an opportunity, Mr. Chair, to speak briefly with Senator Rosen while we were on the House floor together to that point.
How did that go?
Any minute now. Actually, she sounded very optimistic, but there wasn't a whole lot of detail about the optimism. But at least they're staying at it. So today we're going to begin with a review, or we're going to begin today's review with a quick look at the three bills related to human rights. I think many of us, if not all of us, agree that human rights is a core function of government. From there, we're going to move on, as I shared. So we're going to hear from the commissioner, and then we'll hear, I think it's three bills that we have. And again, members, what I'm looking for is quick explanations about what is it that proposals before us are seeking to solve, and how are we solving those. So 5-minute presentations with up to 10 minutes of question and answer. I know some of the bills in the past, or a couple days ago, didn't use up that much time, but some did. Then we're going to hear four bipartisan bills related to gender-based violence prevention and 8 bipartisan bills related to sexual assault prevention. And then we'll hear 7 bills related to police professional development. So with that, we're going to start off with our Commissioner of Human Rights. And Commissioner, welcome. My hope is that, obviously in a concise manner, but that, you know, with commissioners, we'll spend a little bit more time because you're covering a lot more ground than, you know, some of the individual bills that are before us. And again, as we spoke earlier, what we're looking for is the nature of the department's budget requests, what that budget seeks to address on behalf of Minnesotans, how it will address it, and any concerns that the executive branch wishes to share at this moment with approaches that are on the table from both bodies. Now would be a good time to do that. So welcome, Commissioner. I look forward to our conversation here.
So good afternoon. Thank you all for having me here today.
Now, many of you have heard me talk about this budget proposal. For those of you who have not yet had the pleasure, it's wonderful to be in front of you for this first time today. So just a little quick summary for those of you who haven't heard me talk about it. Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's budget for One Minnesota lays out a bold vision for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, one that makes a transformational investment in our work to ensure that all Minnesotans are able to live joyfully, free from discrimination, and rich with opportunity. We'll talk more details right now. For those of you who have heard me talk about the budget proposal before and everyone else, I'm just going to spend some time right now really focusing on the why of this important proposal. So a key focus of our budget proposal is to expand to Bemidji, Duluth, and Worthington to provide better services for businesses, landlords, and community members. This builds on the success of our St. Cloud Regional Office. So why is this investment in Minnesota Department of Human Rights essential right now? Because each of these cities and regions are asking us to be there and want us to be there. In the packet that you have in front of you, you have several letters from all of these cities. And I'm just going to quote Mayor Rita Albrecht from Bemidji right now, where she says, regional offices are invaluable because in-person interactions are often the most helpful in building trusting relationships and providing the best assistance. If your business wants to ensure its policies are equitable and inclusive, the regional office can help you. If your organization wants to learn more about human rights, the regional office can help you. If you or someone you know has experienced discrimination because of their age, sexual orientation, or race, the regional office can help you. If a coworker needs help securing accommodations for a disability at work, the regional office can help you. So why is this investment in Minnesota Department of Human Rights essential right now? Because Minnesota understands it is important to provide exceptional customer service. This is why, for instance, in Bemidji, right now, we currently have offices for the Department of Transportation, Natural Resources, Health, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. All of these offices meaningfully help the people of Bemidji and Northwest Minnesota. So having a local office dedicated to protecting the civil rights of all Minnesotans just makes sense, especially with our changing demographics. And that leads me to my next point of why this investment for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights is important right now. And that's because we have a rapidly changing Minnesota. You're hearing about it across the board in all areas. And it is true, the state's population is increasing. We are getting older. We are facing higher rates of disabilities. We are getting more racially diverse across all of Minnesota. And at the same time, Minnesota has some of the worst racial disparities in the country across the board in housing, employment, education, and health, to name a few. So businesses are deeply aware of this fact that we have these rapidly changing demographics, and they are saying invest in the Department of Human Rights because we need this assistance. They know, businesses know that we are in the middle of a Me Too movement to eradicate sexual harassment. In fact, a report released last month indicated that many more people reporting incidents of harassment in the workplace in 2018 when compared to 2017. Now, this is a national report from a company that provides compliance hotline services to 15,000 companies across the country. And according to its data, the number of harassment complaints was steady from 2016 to 2017, which is too many. But it increased by 25% in 2018, the first full year after the Me Too movement began. So why is this investment important? Because everyone is asking for tools and support to address implicit bias, to understand disability accommodations, and implement different ways to recruit and retain racially diverse staff. So I want to conclude by talking about the last reason why this investment in Minnesota Department of Human Rights is so important right now. And that's because the federal regulators are not getting it done. The Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division, which has been crucial in historic efforts to protect Minnesota's rights alongside the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, has started 60% fewer cases against potential violations during the last 2 years compared to the previous two administrations of both George W. Bush and Barack Obama. These drop in rates and changes to how cases are being handled are also being seen in the EEOC, in HUD, and other federal regulatory agencies. And that's why it's important to make this investment in the Department of Human Rights now. I'm really grateful that the House has joined the governor in the positive vision for Minnesotans and the Department of Human Rights. This proposed budget makes investments to ensure that all Minnesotans are able to live lives free from discrimination and thriving and welcoming communities in every single county across Minnesota. Now, the Senate's current proposal does not match those needed investments. So as this budget process moves forward, I urge you to consider the full funding for the Department of Human Rights. Please let me know how I can be of assistance, and thank you all for your hard work on this issue.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. Members, are there any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering whether the department has seen, it seems like I'm guessing it's seen increased demand for its services. Is that right?
Chair, thank you very much for the question. Yes, we are seeing both an increase in the number of cases as well as the complexity of the cases that we're seeing.
Okay.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so what specific areas are you seeing the demand increase? You kind of described the kind, but are there particular types of cases you're seeing?
Yeah, thank you, Chair, Representative. Yes, we are seeing an increase. The biggest area of our work, hands down, is in disability discrimination. And that's true across every single county in Minnesota. And that's not surprising because we are aging. And as we age, we also experience higher rates of disability. And it's a reminder of how all of these issues are very intersectional. The second area where we see where we're seeing a big increase in demand for our services has to do with issues of race discrimination. And that's not surprising as well, given the context that we're living in right now, where we're seeing increases in hate crimes, increases of concerns of bias in every area. And so those are the two areas where we're seeing an increase. That's everywhere in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one final question. Of course, a lot of what we're doing here is to be looking at the impact of the proposals from each chamber and then trying to harmonize and bring them together. Can you just comment on the impact of the two respective budget proposals on your department from the House and from the Senate and what the impact would be on the important work that you're doing for Minnesotans?
Commissioner.
Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. As I mentioned, the House has joined the governor in the positive vision for Minnesota and the Department of Human Rights, so matches the budget request there. And we've talked about what we'll be able to do with that across the state. Let me talk a little bit about, provide a little bit of context of the Senate bill right now, where we're seeing deep cuts for our department. So leaving the Senate Finance Committee, Chair Limmer's budget proposal provided a modest one-time operational adjustment to fund increasing agency insurance costs. We appreciated that. Importantly, even with the low budget targets provided, Chair Limmer and the committee did not cut MDHR's base funding. Again, we appreciate that. While on the floor, however, the bill was amended to slash the department's base funding by 6% for the coming biennium. And I really want to talk about that, because this cut and no operating adjustment would require us to lay off about 15% of our dedicated staff who provide important services to thousands of Minnesotans across the state. And so that we are a small team. We're small and mighty. There's a little bit of over 40 full-time employees that do work across the entire state. And so laying off 7 employees would be devastating to the services that we're able to provide. Let me give a very specific example. About we issue thousands of workforce and equal pay certificates for businesses across the state. So if you're contracting with Minnesota, you need a workforce and equal pay certificate to do your work. We have a statutory requirement to get back to each business within 15 days and issue those certificates. We would simply not be able to do our part to support Minnesota businesses if we were to have a cut in staff. So that's a very specific example. Additionally, if the Senate version of the bill were to become law, it would dramatically impact service levels when it comes to our investigatory work and put our federal contract obligations with the EEOC at risk. And so I know that that's not an area that we want to go down as well. So in order for us to be responsive to businesses and meet our statutory obligations, the cuts that are being proposed right now in the Senate are absolutely devastating to our department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe just a comment. I know that our Senate colleagues were put in a really difficult position with the budget targets they received. And it sounds like with respect to this department, they did their very, very best with it. But we're still talking with the target that they received with really devastating impact on Minnesotans. And I appreciate the commissioner for her work and for highlighting that. And I certainly hope and trust that the leadership at all levels, the House, Senate, and the governor, recognize the need to give a public safety and judiciary target that doesn't result in those sort of devastating cuts in all these areas. Thank you.
Very well. Is there anyone else? Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, tell me a little about the differences between where you're at now versus what we're proposing in your budget. If I'm a 62-year-old who's, or let's say 65-year-old, let's say I'm an older guy, and I suspect that I'm being discriminated against based on my age or my disability, and I live in Detroit Lakes or Crookston, what types of opportunities do I have now, or am I missing out on, that I would gain if we were able to have that office in Bemidji?
Commissioner.
Chair, Representative Lesh, thank you for that question. We actually have seen on the ground the difference that it makes to have a regional office in St. Cloud, where somebody in that situation feels much more comfortable coming into the office and meeting with somebody on the ground who is a community member and are able to meet face-to-face. A lot of people feel uncomfortable making the phone calls for a variety of reasons. It could be a language issue. It could be a disability issue. It could be because they were sexually assaulted or harassed at work, and it's a very these are people experiencing a really hard moment in their life, and it's something that you always are benefiting from when you're able to talk to someone face to face and build trust around that to get the right information. So we have many of those cases in St. Cloud. The number of cases that have come in the door right now has doubled in the past year as we've built out our St. Cloud office. So we know that it has an impact to be on the ground where people feel more comfortable coming in. I guess I just want to say that there's so many of those cases that we already have investigated and helped people with that it would just be helpful to just share the story for those of you who haven't heard it yet of Mr. Heinrich, who worked as an IT professional at his desk job for over 20 years, and he would type away doing his IT job at his desk, and he had diabetes, and he ended up as a result of his diabetes losing his leg. And he went away from work, came back after surgery recovery, and all of a sudden was required after 20 years on the job to climb into tight crawl spaces and to climb ladders, something that he'd never been required to do before. Because of our involvement and help, we were able to change the policies, get some training, and also support Mr. Heinrich. So there's a lot of people like Mr. Heinrich who aren't able to reach us. And we know we're not helping them, and we're not helping others because we're not on the ground to provide that services.
Mr. Chair.
Chairman Lynch.
Thank you, Commissioner. When I was in law school, I did a clinic for a legal aid agency, and I dealt with a guy who had become disabled, and he had rented a trailer in Clontarf. Does anyone know where Clontarf, Minnesota is? Okay, it's a real town, yeah. It sounds like the name of a Jim Henson's Muppet, but it's a real name of a town, Clontarf. And the guy had rented a trailer out there with a ramp so he could get up. And after a few years, the ramp had rotted out, and he was trying to get the landlord to repair it, and the landlord refused to repair it. He said, I rented it to you as is. You know, I don't care if you can get up or not. And the irony was, no one in the office had ever dealt with this before, because if you're dealing with these legal aid cases in the metro, either got an elevator or there's a ramp there already, or someone has dealt with it before where they know, say, okay, tell the landlord, by the way, here's what you got to do, here's your obligations, both under the lease contract, under housing law and human rights and everything. And he couldn't find anyone out there who was familiar with this or knew how to do it, so he had to rely on someone in the metro to do it, and even we were unfamiliar with it because it was a ramp up to a trailer. So it seems to me that having someone in the community that understands the nuances of all those different dynamics going on at the same time can save everyone a lot of money, a lot of trouble, and a lot of pain in the neck by having those out there. And so that's why I really appreciate your vision of having these offices.
Very well. Commissioner?
Chair Representative Lesch, thank you for that story. Yes, the best kind of discrimination is the kind that never, ever happens in the first place. And in our St. Cloud office, where we see an increase of cases coming in from tenants like this, our staff are able to quickly meet with landlords and say, hey, just want to make sure everyone understands what the fair housing laws are to prevent that from ever happening again. And it's only because they were on the ground there that they had the relationships with landlords and they could react quickly to prevent further discriminations from even happening, regardless of how those cases moved forward. I appreciate your comment.
Thank you, Commissioner. I really appreciate the sharing of the juxtaposition of human rights and economic prosperity. One of the things that a number of us heard when there were presentations early in the year here with the forecasting for the state's budget was that one of the factors that were posing some challenges and some worrisome things for us to think about has to do with the nature of the changing workforce and the need, therefore, to diversify the source of our workforce. And it seems to me that that's what these businesses, small businesses in particular, are engaging with your department with. And so it may be a small issue in one community, but it's a big issue because that apparently is multiplying in terms of an impact across the state, so much so that our budget forecasts apparently are increasingly cognizant of the need to pay attention to the challenges of a diversified, accessing a diversified workforce. So very quickly, I'll leave it to either Senator Anderson or to Chair Lesch to tell us where Quantas, is that Quantor? Quator?
I forgot to mispronounce it again now, but Senator Anderson knows how to pronounce it.
You're talking about
Quantar? Quantar. Yeah. I don't know where it is. I've never.
Where is it?
It's in Senator Lang's district. My cousin lives there.
Is there anyone else that lives there?
Never mind.
Very well. Commissioner, my understanding is you'll be talking about the next three bills that we have. Is that correct?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Oh, and Representative Contrell, you might as well come join us as well. And Representative Lee. Commissioner, I think you can stay there. And we'll just sort of congregate around the table and try to move as quickly as we can. We'll start with House File 2062, Classifying Workforce Certificate Compliance Data. And Commissioner, I think that's you and your staff. And members, you'll find that in the bill, House Bill, page 256, and in our the first one, there. And then that's Article 20. Very well. So, Commissioner, House File 2062.
Chair, thank you so much. I'm going to ask Scott Butel, our Assistant Commissioner, to take over at this point.
Welcome, Mr. Butel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Butel. I am the Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. So this section, which is on page 256, lines 256.19 through 256.25, is an agency bill that was carried by Representative Ray Dean. We're grateful for him being able to author that. And that deals with specifically providing a data classification for the data which the department collects from Workforce Certificate of Compliance holders. These are state contractors with contracts over $100,000 that submit an affirmative action plan to the state, get a workforce certificate that's good for 4 years. Right now, there isn't a specific data classification that's within the Human Rights Act for the workforce certificate, but there is a specific data classification for the equal pay certificate, which is 363A44. And so in conversation with contractors, there was some concern that not having that specific data classification was something that they felt a little bit of confusion about. So we've put in a specific data classification to protect the information that they submit around like personnel, policies, pay, things like that that they might provide as part of an audit. And in moving that bill forward, we had some good conversations with Minkoji, Mr. Neumeister, others who are concerned about data, and made some minor tweaks there to make sure that within that bill language, sort of the initial forms that they provided would remain public, so folks would know kind of who was submitting those things. So simple technical bill, and I'll also say that essentially all of this data at this point would already be covered under the trade secrets provision of Chapter 13, and so this is just providing some really easy clarity for the state's business partners.
Okay, very well. So it's a department bill. Representative Dean is carrying it, but it's a proposal that's come forward from the department. Members, any questions? All right, well then. Let's move on to House File 2000, Representative Lee, contractors on bond projects covered by compliance requirements, and this, I believe, is also a department proposal. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, members, that's on page 255, Article 20.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my provision of the bill would amend the Minnesota Human Rights Act so that bonding projects undertaken by local units of government fall under the Department of Human Rights workforce goals and equal pay protections. It required that all projects that meet the funding threshold, regardless of what entity is running them, to comply with the equity requirements.
Very well. Members, any questions? Clear as day. So thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Cantrell, House File 2001 on page 256, Article 20 also, technical changes to the Department of Human Rights compliance requirements. Representative Cantrell, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 2001 makes technical changes and not substantive changes to the workforce certificates of compliance statutes under the Department of Human Rights. It essentially combines paragraphs A and B of the existing statute and just clarifies the intentions of sections A and B. So it's solely technical in nature.
Very well. Members, questions? Commissioner, since there aren't any questions, I'll look to you for a few seconds about the significance of these three minor but seems like pretty important proposals.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think it's just really important as we're doing our work that we want to be really good partners with the businesses across Minnesota. And so all three of these bills help us in our work to make sure that when we're working with our business partners, that they feel comfortable working with us and that we're doing our job correctly on their behalf. So this is about good customer service and being good partners.
Good government, in other words. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, do we know, was this language introduced in the Senate, and if so, did it receive a hearing?
Mr. Butel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto. These, all three of these bills did have companions introduced in the Senate. These three bills were not heard. There was one other agency technical bill. I believe it's House File 2004, and I'm forgetting the Senate file number that Senator Lapps carried that is currently rolled up into Senator Limmer's omnibus data bill. So, but these three were not heard in the Senate.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Pinsel. And members, in the packet that was handed out that has the front page, it says agenda on it. The first several pages we'll give you background information on the Department of Human Rights testimony, including some supportive letters from, I think, primarily under regional centers' proposal, and then brief language on the three bills that we just quickly went through. Representative Pinto, part of why we're doing what we're doing is in order to make sure that our Senate counterparts get to hear what we've heard that they've not heard, as a way to be prepared as we get into the process of putting offers on the table for consideration of folding into the final omnibus bill. Well, gentlemen and Commissioner, thank you
Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you, Mr.
For
Chair.
Your work, Commissioner, and look forward to keeping this conversation going over the next week and a half. With that, members, we're going to move to the gender-based violence prevention part of these presentations. These are going to encompass four bipartisan bills, and we're going to start with House File 10, which is Representative Mueller's bill. And Representative Mueller, you're welcome to stay right there at your seat. And I think you might have a testifier as well. Or...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Only if there are questions for her will I have a testifier. So, Mr. Chair and members, this is the sexual harassment bill. And just by way of background, this is the bill that Majority Leader Pepin carried last year in the House and that passed almost unanimously in the House last year. And it removes the severe pervasive language from the sexual harassment statute so that it allows victims to have their day in court. This bill is really necessary to make sure that workers are safe in their workplaces. And after we heard the committee this year in the Judiciary Civil Law, after we heard the bill in our committee this year, we had the same language that Representative Pepin carried last year, and we heard some concerns from some in the working world and the League of Cities, and even some, from some of our members on committee about the language not having enough guardrails. So what I did was I worked really hard to reach out to those groups who had concerns about the language. And by the time that we brought the bill to the House floor, we put those guardrails and we really heard those concerns that folks had about the bill, and we added those guardrails to the bill. And so the language that you see in your binder begins on page 254, and a couple of the changes we made were we added the word offensive or materially to the word offensive. We added in that a reasonable person in similar circumstances would find the environment hostile, and then we added in that a totality of the circumstance test be applied. So we really added in those guardrails, and the bill passed, I think, with only 10 no votes on the House floor. And I'm really excited about the bill, and I hope that it's something that you will consider supporting.
Very well. Members, questions? And Mr. Chair, I take it that last year you had, obviously, with I think within the Pepin bill, when you worked on putting together the final bill that went to the governor, you had an opportunity to review at least that language at that time. And, of course, there are differences here, but it sounds like there's familiarity and some engagement in the past on this issue on the Senate side.
Mr. Chair, we've done our review of it. We did not have any hearings. We did have a preliminary hearing, I believe it was in the Jobs Committee, but it wasn't a corresponding companion bill with the House provision. I believe it's Senator Housley's bill, or is that the same number, companion number, but a different, slightly different direction?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yes, the Housley bill wasn't a companion bill, and that actually inserted the severe pervasive language into the statute. I think you did hear testimony from a victim survivor in that case, whose name is Amy, and I forgot to point out that a letter, she couldn't be here today, but a letter is in your packet on page 17 explaining why she really likes the language in our bill. We feel it really gives the victims a chance to have their day in court.
Very well. Further questions? If not, then we'll move on to House File 464, Representative O'Neill. This is found on page 12, article, we don't know yet, but perhaps article 1, since it's page 12. Yeah. Representative O'Neill, House File 464, establishing the Domestic Abuse Transformation Program Fund. And you have someone with you as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do. Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, the executive director, is here with me, and she could kind of explain the uniqueness of this program. But before I turn it over to her, this is an approach that should be done but isn't often done. This is working with the abuser. So this is working with the person that is committing the violence. And normally we're working with victims and trying to get them away from the abuser and start them on a new life. But that abuser is still in society and is just looking for the next victim typically. So this is actually a transformation program, or it would be a grant program to do that, to fund this program where domestic abusers would actually receive help and treatment to change their behavior. And with that, I will turn it over to the Executive Director of Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women.
Very well. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, members of the committee. I'm Liz Richards, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. In both the House and the Senate funding bills, there is money allocated for programming to transform the behaviors of perpetrators of domestic violence. The House has allocated $818,000 for the request that's made specifically in House File 464. The House allocated an additional $200,000 specific to veterans, and the Senate allocated $398,000 for veterans programming. Each of these allocations is for programming that it's about transforming the behavior of perpetrators of domestic violence. Well, Minnesota has a long history of financially supporting domestic violence work. This will be the first time that the state will invest in programming to prevent domestic violence. It'll invest in programming to transform perpetrators' behaviors. At a time when everyone is grappling with how to reform the criminal justice system, how to do prison reform reforms, it's essential that we have an investment in programming to transform domestic violence behaviors. Perpetrators of domestic violence are a growing percentage of the prison and jail populations in this state. And domestic violence crimes, including domestic violence homicides, continue at an unacceptable rate. So the solution to domestic violence is not to lock up people for long-term prison sentences. And neither is the solution to release them out into the community without any programming. The solution is to promote programming that has been shown to transform behaviors, to prevent future violence, and to save the lives of domestic violence victims. The solution is in programs like the Step Up program. This is just one of these programs. It's functioned by the Refuge. They function in Chisago, Isanti, Pine, and Kennebec counties. The Step Up program works with perpetrators of domestic violence. And the Refuge right now is funding this program solely through thrift store funding. And at this rate, they're able to offer one group a year in each county. And that is, this is for a program that has a recidivism rate of less than 10%. And at the same time, there's constant demand for more groups. We have 40% of the counties in Minnesota that have absolutely no programming. And most of the rest have insufficient programming. I know that the legislature wants to make investments in programming that's proven to be effective, with a real emphasis on evidence-based research. Our programs who are doing this work track the recidivism rates and they track the effectiveness, but this information is often not captured in research. The state has made significant investments in victim safety, providing shelter and advocacy. But until there's an investment to change perpetrators' behaviors, there will always be the next victim. Domestic violence will continue. We are asking that you fund this programming to transform perpetrator domestic violence behavior and do so at a level that can provide effective programming throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Are there any questions? Representative Pinkel.
Just a really small thing. Representative O'Neill, in the introduction, had referenced trying to get the abuser on a better path when the relationship has ended. And I guess I just want to ask, and maybe it's Ms. Richards, it seems like a lot of the value of this, too, is that people do, in fact, stay in relationships that are maybe unhealthy. And so we also want to be getting the abuser on a better path, even just for the current victim survivor, for that as well. Just if she could briefly comment on that.
Ms. Richards.
Chair, Representative Pinto, that's absolutely true. That we know many of the people who have experienced domestic violence ultimately will stay together or want to stay together, and that almost everybody who's a perpetrator of domestic violence gets involved in a future relationship. So both for future potential victims or for the victim, changing behavior is absolutely critical.
And Mr. Chair.
I
just wanted to put this into a bit of perspective, too. I know that the DOC had done a study of those that were incarcerated. This was a couple years back. But they found that about 60% of those at that time that were incarcerated had a domestic violence charge. And so it's a pretty high correlation for those that are sitting in our prison system. About 10,000 folks at any given moment are in our prison system. So if we can help them get on a better path, not only will they save the relationship that they're in, but as we stated, the future relationships as well and future abused women.
It seems the recidivism rates here are actually quite outstanding. Rather, the non-recidivists are quite outstanding. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Neill, for bringing this bill, and to Liz Richards, too, for your leadership on this area. And just a question, is this targeted to a specific group of defendants who are batterers, or is this a more general approach?
Ms. Richards.
Well, yeah.
Chair, Representative, the funding under House File 464 is funding that will go broadly. It's to go to the Office of Justice Programming to issue out in a grant program to qualifying programs throughout the state. So it's not targeted to any specific program.
Very well. Members, you'll find the corresponding appropriation on the spreadsheet on line 179. The House has $1.6 million for the biennium invested in this particular approach. And I think the Representative Mueller's question, the approach here is meant to be broad in scope in terms of identifying offenders across many different categories. I do note that on line 180, there's also a veterans domestic abuse prevention program, which sounds very similar, but obviously targeted at a very specific group of folks. And Mr. Chair, it seems to me that this is one of the areas where the House and the Senate share some common interests and perhaps common vision. My hope is that it'll serve as a fertile ground for us to be able to do some work together and invest as we put our omnibus bill together. All right. Very well. Thank you, Ms. Richards. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Thank you for all your work this year, quite frankly. It's been a... Yes, you will, indeed. Representative Pinto, House File 901, adding domestic abuse, no contact orders to list of evidence. Found on page 47. I suspect that's Article 1 as well. Oh, it is Article 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's true, and if folks are looking at the bill's summary from House Research, it's on page 11. It's section 24. So there are... there's a presumption under our law, or a set of evidentiary standards that are codified in Minnesota Statute 634.20 that make it a little bit easier to introduce evidence of past bad acts by defendants, easier to do so in domestic cases than in other cases as well. And this provision simply does a cleanup of adding a violation of a domestic abuse no contact order to the list of past crimes that can be introduced as evidence in a current case. Violations of orders for protection are included in the list, and other protective orders of harassment restraining orders. This simply cleans that up by adding violation of DANCO's domestic abuse no contact orders to that list as well. I believe I have the support of our county attorney association for that. Please speak up if I'm saying that wrong, but I recall that being the case. And as a prosecutor who specialized in domestic violence and gender violence myself, I would find this helpful. And again, my fellow prosecutors around the state would as well. I think that's all.
Thank you. Are there any questions? All right. Then if not, Representative Pinto, you also have House File 560, clarifying crimes of harassment and stalking. That's found on page 41, and that's Article 2 as well.
That is correct, Mr. Chair, and a similar area of the bill summary. There is a crime that in the past was called harassment. That was when there was a single incident of where one individual was subjecting another to the treatment that is defined under that, as one would think, sort of the common sense meaning of the term harassment. If that behavior happens more than once, then in the past that was called stalking. Well, a number of years ago, those two crimes changed names to a single incident is called stalking, and multiple incidents is called pattern of stalking conduct, which if you describe it that way feels a little oxymoronic, feels a little bit strange, since we think of stalking probably as being a pattern. But again, right now under our law, a single incident is called stalking, and not a pattern, just a single incident, and multiple incidents is called pattern of stalking conduct. This bill would simply return those terms back to the original terms Harassment is a single incident. Stalking is multiple incidents. Again, the support of our state's county attorneys worked with the Coalition for Battered Women and others on this. And I would say this is a challenge that I've experienced in my own work, and again, have the support of fellow prosecutors. It is confusing for juries when you try to explain to them that a single incident is in fact something called stalking. They have trouble thinking of that, and I found that with police officers presenting cases and others, that it is a hindrance to public safety, and this is a small change that will make a big difference.
Very well. Any questions? Representative Chairlish.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto, I can't remember if this came up in committee, and if it did, I didn't hear it. Who changed that, and when did they? I bet you they're sitting in this room. Well, whoever was behind a change in it is sitting in this room right now, and I'm kind of curious as to what the rationale was for it back then. Somebody can answer the question in here. They're probably not going to speak up, but I just am. I'd kind of like to know. There's probably a good reason for it.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh. You know, I've heard multiple explanations, actually. So the explanation that I'd heard initially was that there was a thought, and I guess I've heard this a little bit in response to this proposed change, so I think we've worked through this, but the concern that harassment may understate the significance of this. Even a single incident, one moment of something we define as harassment, can be extremely devastating for the person receiving it, having inflicted upon them. And so what I had heard was that the thought was that that calling a single incident harassment, multiple stalking, somehow undervalues that single incident, that calling it stalking puts a stronger emphasis. That's what I had heard, and that the thought was that this really is a strong statement by our state against stalking and harassment, which, of course, we want to do. I just had the experience, I think you have as well as a former prosecutor, that it's if you get ahead of a jury's common sense understanding of terms, that's when you get to be problematic. But I'd heard that explanation, and then I'd heard from others that wasn't necessarily so true, and that it just got caught up in some other statutory change. There may be somebody else in the room who knows the actual answer, but I've heard multiple things from multiple people.
Thank you. Well, Mr.
Chair Lesh.
And Representative Pinto, I know there's someone in the room who knows the answer, but they're not going to say anything, but just because they don't want to have to answer questions, which I don't blame them. But I think that's a good explanation, as any, so thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto, it does seem common sense to me, in particular as I think about lay people. So the issue about jurors, perhaps, you know, even some law enforcement. But I think if I were ever allowed on a jury panel, which I'm sure I will not be, they don't tend to put people like us on jury panels. I think
well,
I would
yes,
be.
They do.
Oh, do they? Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I stand corrected.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one final point. It is, for those who have not prosecuted domestic violence cases, it can be extremely difficult, and you're really trying to get a ball through a very small hoop that's very far away. It can be very difficult, and to have that one spot of a jury having a little bit of trouble with it mentally to make that leap to say, yes, this individual incident is in fact stalking, that can make the difference. So this is would be a helpful change in my view and the view of other prosecutors as well. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Pinto. We're going to move on. You know, this is just, it's only four bills of the gender-based violence prevention proposals that we heard. We actually began our session with a heavy focus on having voice for survivors and victims of gender-based violence. But these are the ones that really rose to the top in terms of things that we can readily do and that seem righteous to do at this point in time. With that, members, we're going to move on to another theme area, sexual assault prevention work. And here we have eight bipartisan bills. And I do want to point out, members, you know, just a brief aside here, that in terms of what motivated the House, I suspect what motivates the Senate as well, is the realities that just even in recent years we've seen an increase in numbers of rapes, sexual assaults reported in the state from 2016 to 17, we saw a 4.7% increase in that. Perhaps more importantly, the clearance rate for other offenses are actually pretty high. So in DWI, you know, we're running in 2017 about 95% clearance rates. That kind of makes sense, right? Drug offenses, 85%. However, that contrasts with the clearance rates for rape offenses of 38%. And that really speaks to the issue that the Big Star Tribune series really shed a light on toward the end of last year. It was sort of like a justice denied series. And so a number of these bills look to address that that reality in our state. And with that, we're going to start with Representative Pinto, House File 2785, Establishing Sex Trafficking Investigations Coordinator, found on page 29 in Article 2.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the House are aware, but members of the Senate may not be, that I served for several years as the Director of Statewide Training and Protocol Development for the Safe Harbor Systems. This is Minnesota's system to address the exploitation of sexual exploitation of youth in particular. And so, as I said, as part of that work, trained thousands of police officers and other professionals and helped to develop our state's model protocols and model policies to address this issue. This proposal comes out of that work. Several years ago, it was then Chair Cornish and then Chair Latz who moved forward funding to fund sex trafficking investigation grants that go out statewide and are currently funding the investigation of sex trafficking and local investigations. But there does seem to me to be a need for coordination of that work for a number of reasons. And so this proposal that's referenced, it's on pages 29 and 30 of the bill, of the House bill, would establish a coordinator for that work to ensure high-quality training and make sure that there are standards being followed. This would parallel in many ways a similar coordinator that's in place for the violent crime enforcement teams throughout the state and would be housed at the Office of Justice Programs as well. I think that gives a pretty good sense of it, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Are there questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Limmer.
I had a question for Representative Pinto. You said you wanted it under the auspices of the Office of Justice. Why wouldn't it be under Department of Public Safety or BCA?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Limmer. So and I wonder, we may need a different title for it, Chair Limmer, because I feel like there's been some confusion in the way it's written. It's intended to parallel the role that is currently in OJP as well, overseeing the work of the VSETs, the Violent Crime Enforcement Teams. And this role would not be overseeing the investigation of sex trafficking cases. So this is not somebody who has an active role overseeing cases, just like the person who's in OJP right now in that role for the VSETs is not overseeing drug or gun investigations. Rather, the purpose is to coordinate our states, coordinate those task forces that are in fact doing that work to make sure that there is deconfliction among them, to make sure that there is, right now they're spending a lot of time doing training and community awareness and to make sure that, so that they have that work be sort of coordinated, make sure that it's a high quality, to make sure that there is, that there are certain standards for how the work is being done, just similarly as there is in terms of gun investigations and drug investigations. So just as it is in that area, it would be in this as well within OJP.
And Chairman Limmer.
Representative Pinto, I noticed that the Senate did not have a bill in its chamber regarding this. It seems like it came in a little late, so we're trying to catch up, and I don't think we even have a Senate author on it, so unless it was just filed recently. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, Chair Limmer, it definitely did. This is something that was resulting from a series of conversations over a number of months, and as you know, the way that things get pulled together quickly. And so it actually did come right quickly as our House bill was coming together. And so in that way, there may not be, it may be that with the rush of those omnibus bills that there's not a Senate companion that was introduced as of yet. But I can look into that. Things came together pretty quickly. So, thank you.
And members, you'll find the appropriation related to this on line 183. We need bigger text. See that? I'm just getting older here. Yeah. On line 183, and actually, Representative Pinto, you and I had a quick conversation recently. It actually seems like a pretty low number for a coordinator, $100,000 a year, but that is what it is on the spreadsheet at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I should note, yeah, I think that we were hoping to get a fiscal note from the department, an estimate as to the specific amount. I forget precisely where that, if that $100,000 came directly from the department. And to confirm, I would be eager to talk with Chair Limmer or any members of the Senate. This is an idea that I've been, and many others who were in this anti-trafficking space have been considering for a while now, because we do have, there's been funding going out for these grants. We want to make sure that that's being used in the best way possible and that those different investigation efforts are being coordinated the best way possible. This, in my view, is a really good way to do it, but certainly eager to talk with my colleagues in the other chamber about that as well. So thank you to both chairs.
Mr. Chair.
Chairman Limmer.
Yes.
Perhaps, Representative Pinnell, you know, I believe in 2018 when the Super Bowl was here, there was a big bust on sex trafficking, and then it just more recently in the Final Four of 2019. Yeah, do you know what? Who coordinated those investigations? Was it local or was it some of the larger task force?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Limmer, I believe that it was there were a number of those task forces working together. And you know, it's for those of us in this work, it's interesting. Those high profile events, there certainly is a spike in trafficking exploitation. But when you compare to the base, there really is so much that goes on a daily basis that the increase for any one event, even an event as big as the Super Bowl, the Final Four, is actually not all that big compared to the base. There's so much that goes on. But in response to in that particular situation, my understanding is there were a number of agencies, including those that have been receiving the state funding, as you've supported and others as well over these past couple years.
Mr. Chairman, just a general comment about sex trafficking. We in the legislature are more reactive to just about everything. And we're reacting now with ideas of resourcing to combat the supply of what's being provided, but we really don't look at the demand. And it's a cultural thing. It's deeply ingrained. I believe it's hidden. And I think for the most part, the demand is perpetrated by men. And yet, we haven't seen too many pieces of legislation going in that direction. And I'm kind of anxious to do that. Same with the illicit drug trade. We rush, and opioids, we rush on the supply side. But, I mean, on the demand side, but we aren't necessarily rushing to plug the holes of the supply lines that are coming up from Mexico. And so I'm kind of confused. We're kind of doing half the job. And I know this isn't part of what we're talking on now for the purposes of our conference, but I just thought, since I had a spare moment, I think we really need to get something going on how to combat the demand. And especially how we address the cultural aspects of that, and the and it's no surprise we have to focus on men who are demanding that or searching it out, because the supply isn't going to come without the demand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well said, Chair Limmer. I do think there's a number of ideas that are moving forward on the demand side, and I'll be eager to chat with you further about them. But overall, very well said, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Limmer, I think you've identified work that perhaps you and I and our respective committees can be a little bit tighter next year in terms of putting some things forward that are much more proactive, for sure. I think later on we're going to hear from Representative Mueller on the working group, and I think there's a large part of that philosophy is embedded within that proposal in terms of wanting to be proactive. Representative Pinto, you mentioned the VSEP, and I just learned about this in recent years, but I think you talked about the model. I know I'm belaboring a little bit here, members, but you know, along with Chairman Limmer's observation, it seems to me that the VSEP work in terms of the coordinating approach would really reflect that sort of proactive nature, but maybe I'm wrong. So if you, at any rate, if you can just sort of decipher us quickly what that is.
Mr. Chair, my understanding, although there's plenty of people in the room who know more about this than I do, so I'll save it. Somebody please correct me. There's a violent crime enforcement teams, VSETs, that do receive both state and, I believe, federal funding as well. And that are in a number of communities around the state. I think there's, so there's funding that goes to them. There's a violent crime coordinating council and there's a coordinator at the Office of Justice Programs who, again, is in parallel to the position that we're proposing with respect to sex trafficking investigations. A lot of that role is to make sure that those enforcement teams are following certain protocols. Of course, you're working with drugs, you're working with money, you're working with guns, you're working with items of value, and want to make sure that that's all being done properly. And there's a lot that's going into it, but I think certainly, and I think many of us would agree that certainly when it comes to drug investigations, per Senator Limmer's point, Chair Limmer's point, there's a lot that we could be doing proactively to not just be going after those who are selling, et cetera, but making sure on the demand side as well. So thank you.
Chairman Limmer. While we're on the VSET issue, it's not seen in our budget proposal that Senator Rosen has in her opioid bill, in a HHS bill, $4 million to be allocated to VSET operations. So let's keep that in mind as we consider our budget, that $4 million new dollars toward that, although it was probably geared more toward addressing drug issues on the illicit scale, it'll blur into the whole operation and make their operations much stronger, a little more expansive. They could put maybe a little more focus on, as a result, put more focus on sex trafficking as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, Chair Limmer, I believe right now we spend about $4 million on the VSETs drug and gun investigation. I think we spend about $1 million on human trafficking. So there's, you know, drug trafficking versus human trafficking, and we're spending about four times as much. And so, yeah, I do think that having some certainly increasing our focus on the trafficking of people and the exploitation, I think would make a lot of sense. So, yeah, thank you for that.
Well, members, we're going to move on. Representative Damon. I'm sorry. Hold on a second. I'm sorry. Chairman Lush.
Thank you. Representative Pinto, I just wanted to make sure I understood the title of this position. I had in, I think it was the research summary, page 7, said it was statewide sex trafficking coordinator. And in your bill, I just wanted to confirm this was, I was looking for it. I think I finally found it. It's investigations. Title of the position is the statewide sex trafficking investigations coordinator. Is that right?
Thank you, Mr. It's definitely not the sex trafficking coordinator, just to be clear on that. But I think you've highlighted, Senator Limbaugh, too, that it is a little confusing because it's not someone who has operational responsibility. So I wonder if there may be a better way to title that, to be clear that it's not somebody, you know, with operational responsibility over task forces, but rather that broader position. But
okay, just wanted to make sure there weren't any. But I had asked a question and then I looked through the language. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and found it. I think I'm satisfied with it, but I just wanted to confirm that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sounds like a simple amendment, Representative Pinto. Very well, then. There are no further questions, Representative Damuth, and Mr. Bastrom is with you, and so we want to make sure we honor his time here today. Representative Damuth, you have House File 491. And again, what we're looking for is a quick explanation of what House File 491 seeks to address, why it's important, and how it seeks to do that. Representative Damon.
Excellent. Thank you, Chair Mariani, for including House File 491 in the House Public Safety and Judiciary Omnibus. Thank you, Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present today. This provision increases the age from 18 to 21 for third and fourth degree criminal sexual conduct if the victim is a secondary school student and the perpetrator is a school employee or contractor and in a position of authority over the student. There were two cases in Dakota County involving high school teachers and coaches who had sexual relations with 18-year-old high school students. Our criminal sexual conduct laws make this conduct a crime if that student is 17, but when that same student turns 18, it is no longer a crime. The fact that a high school student turns 18 does not change the dynamics of that student with a teacher in a classroom or with a student and a coach in the gym or on a field. The provision is narrowly crafted to apply to only high school students who have not yet graduated and school employees, contractors, or volunteers who are in a position of authority over that student. This bill is supported by Dakota County Attorney Jim Backstrom, and with your permission, Mr. Chair, I would turn it over to him.
Very well. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Backstrom.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney. As Representative DeMuth has indicated, this is a bill that I strongly support. It's a bill that needs to be changed, or a bill that needs to be enacted, a law that needs to be changed in our state to address this significant situation where high school students who are still in high school, and it can be up to age 21, particularly for special needs students, once they turn 18, and if they're still in high school, there is no prohibition under Minnesota law for a teacher, coach, school administrator, independent contractor, volunteer, anyone in a position of authority that's working with a school district over a student to have a sexual relationship with that child and a young adult, I guess, if you're turned 18, but still a secondary school student. And it's simply not appropriate, in my view, for that to occur. These are still individuals who are in high school, in a secondary school. These relationships, even though they may supposedly be consensual, these students can easily be manipulated into those type of sexual relationships which can have long-term negative impacts on their lives. And that's the purpose behind this bill. I think it's a very important change in our law, and I would strongly encourage the committee to move forward and consider this. Thank you.
Very well. Are there any questions?
Yes, Chair.
Chairman Lesh.
Thank you. I'll preface my comments as saying that I agree with this in principle, but I think it highlights the difficulty of where we're drawing that line. And we said in previously in committee when this came through, this comes down to, you know, historically, we've drawn the line at 18. This is where it's appropriate and this is where it's not appropriate, at least according to law. I would maintain that it's completely inappropriate for a college professor when these kids are well north of 18. And most colleges have policies in place prohibiting that, but we don't have a law against it. I think this highlights the difficulty of when we think we've drawn a neat line at something like an age, as opposed to, say, a date of graduation, that we start to stray from that for one reason or another for what may be good reasons, but then we end up having to grapple with that somewhere down the line. So I'm not speaking against the bill, but I do think it's important to remind us that who knows what kinds of corollary effects occur when we start messing around with what was once a bright line, and it makes it a little bit more complicated for people as well.
Thank you, Chairman Lesher. Mr. Backstrom, we did have a little bit of this conversation, I believe, when we heard the bill. I don't know if you want to add anything to it. It seems to me that the issue here is a recognition of the, I mean, I think it's a legitimate, absolutely legitimate question to ask, but it seems to me that the issue here really relates to the whole position of authority, particularly within a setting where there is this essentially a minor adult relationship and where that can move over time just by virtue of the fact that we have legal adults within our K-12 system who are looking to finish off what they started as minors. So offer any quick thoughts on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Lesh, I certainly understand your point. The I guess my view of this issue is that there is a difference that needs to be recognized in terms of someone who has not yet graduated from a secondary school. That is a different a concept, and I certainly think that there would not be many parents out there of a student who is still in high school and hasn't graduated that would think it would be okay, that it would be legal for their their child to have a sexual relationship with someone who's in a position of authority over them in that school. And that's why I think it's important to make that distinction. And yes, I understand the college issue too. I don't condone that. It's wrong. But it's, I think, a different situation once you've graduated from high school than it is afterwards. No, thank you. Or before you graduate from high school. Thank you.
It's a good debate. I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, I know that the Senate has similar language. I'd like to call on House Research, Mr. Debo, to talk quickly about comparing what the comparisons or contrasts are in those languages, and perhaps Mr. Bacchus, you might want to weigh in as well. But Mr. Debo.
Mr. Chair and members, the House and Senate have similar provisions on amending the position of authority language and definition in respect to current or recent positions of authority and assuming the position of authority. But the Senate has not taken a position on this proposal extending it to victims who are over 18 in the school setting. And I'd defer to Senate counsel to for an explanation or where that bill is in the Senate.
Mr. Beck?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, Mr. Diebel is correct. We do have the other provisions on current or recent. We do not have this concept, though. It was introduced in the Senate, never heard.
Very well. Any further questions? If not, thank you, Representative David. Thank you for bringing us this bill this year. Thank you, Mr. Baxter.
Yes. Chair Mariani, Chair Limmer, and committee members, thank you for your work, and thanks for hearing this.
Very well. Representative Gomez, House File 734. So House File 734, authored by Representative Gomez, Criminal Sexual Conduct, Statute of Limitations Eliminated, page 108. And that is in Article 5. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. House File 734 eliminates the statute of limitations for certain sex offenses. There you have between 3 and 9 years to report these incidents, and this just removes the statute of limitations for everything moving forward. So I have Asma Muhammad and Sarah Super are joining me up here, and I think Asma is going to provide a few remarks.
Hi. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Muhammad.
Thank you, Chair, committee members. My name is Asma Muhammad, and I'm here on behalf of Reviving the Islamic Sisterhood for Empowerment. I'm a survivor of sexual violence, as is sitting here, Sarah Super. We've been working on this bill for 2 years now. In the past, we weren't able to move it forward, and we're really grateful that you are hearing this today. So this bill would eliminate the criminal statute of limitations for reporting cases of sexual misconduct. I personally was assaulted when I was 12, and 15 years later, when I was finally ready to talk about it, I could no longer report. So when I finally told that story, five more women came to me and shared their stories with me, and none of us could do anything because it had been more than 6 years. So the law in that case was protecting the perpetrator and not us. We're the survivors. So we hear stories about Bill Cosby, about Harvey Weinstein, but in California, they eliminated the statute so they could prosecute in those cases. We have Harvey Weinsteins and we have Bill Cosbys in our own communities. We see this happening with the Boy Scouts of America, where 12,000 cases of sexual abuse have just been uncovered. So the question that we have is, why are we protecting perpetrators when we can protect survivors by removing this criminal statute? So we ask you, committee members, chair, to consider this, because it would protect not us, but going forward. It's not a retroactive change, but it would going forward change this, so then people who are sexually assaulted in the future, and they will be, right, we see this happening with boys, girls of all ages, that they would be able to report whenever it makes sense for them, that whenever they are ready and they can heal. For me, it took me 15 years to be able to heal and tell my story, that they can report when that time comes for them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Muhammad. And I'm sorry, do you wish to testify as well?
Thank you, Chair. My name is Sarah Super. I would add that what we understand about sexual violence is that people have been stigmatized to keep their stories hidden and in silence for often decades after they have experienced sexual abuse, sexual assault, and rape. We also understand that the neuroscience around traumatic memory is very different than the way in which we remember other events in our lifetime. I'd like to add that while if a victim of sexual assault or rape reports their assault the day after, there are still many challenges to prosecuting that crime. As people wait even longer, it becomes even harder, and we recognize that. The cases in which eliminating the statute of limitations would be most useful would be in cases where there are serial sexual offenses or a serial sexual offender in which multiple people, such as in the case of Bill Cosby, multiple, if not dozens of people can come forward and have their cases be heard. I would also add that in the context of being sexually assaulted, the victim's choices are taken away. Literally, the person is forced to endure what's happening to them against their will, against their choice. So to have choices, to have the choice to report, even if we don't control the outcome of the case, but to have the choice to report would be a very essential part of a survivor's healing. And I strongly urge you to support eliminating the criminal statute of limitations.
Thank you, Ms. Super. Are there questions? Chairman Lumber.
Ms. Chair, maybe one of our researchers could help me. We do not have a statute of limitations when it involves a child. Is that correct?
Super. It sounds like you might have an answer.
Chair, we do have something that was filed called the Child Victims Act, but that eliminated the statute of limitations for civil suits. And so now you see more civil suits of child abuse coming forward, such as against the church or the Boy Scouts. But we have not yet removed the criminal statute of limitations for child sexual abuse.
Mr. Backus? I'm sorry.
Chairman Lumber, I think you wanted to reference Mr. Backus.
I should have gone through you, Mr. Chair. Right. I'm sorry.
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair, members, currently for a crime, for criminal sexual conduct, if the crime occurs, involves a victim who's a minor, the victim can bring the case anytime within 9 years of the offense or 3 years of reporting it to law enforcement, whichever is later. So essentially, a child victim can bring the offense to law enforcement at any time.
Chair, I would argue that any time is not three to nine years is not any time. 3 to 9 years is a statute of limitations.
Mr. Chair, it says within the later of 9 years after the commission of the offense or 3 years after the offense was reported to law enforcement.
I would just point out too, with the 3 years after the offense was reported to law enforcement authorities, depends on if law enforcement does something with that information. So, you know, your clock could start to run then if you report it and then nothing happens.
Ms. Chair, the difficulty that I see is, with no statute of limitations, and as long and a longer time elapses from the event of the crime, things like evidence may be destroyed or disappear. Memories may not be accurate. Chances of a conviction may be difficult. So the longer we step away from the actual date of the crime, it naturally becomes nearly impossible for a conviction, I would imagine. And so is the ultimate goal the conviction without a statute of limitations?
Thank you, Chair. So currently, how we are seeing this is that people are not seeing convictions overall. So less than 1% of people that have committed rape or sexual assault are seeing any kinds of consequences, and that's across the board. So I don't know that conviction is, I mean, for many people who are choosing to report, conviction is the goal, or some kind of restorative justice or consequences that make sense for them. But to have that choice to report is what's incredibly important in this, that we don't have a choice. So in cases like Sarah mentioned, of serial perpetrators, that these reports could be brought up later on. So for me, for the five women that were assaulted by the same person, that we could look at this as a serial act.
And Mr. Chair, I understand that if there's DNA evidence, then there is no statute of limitations.
But we are, sorry, Chair. Yes, Chair, we are seeing that DNA evidence has been destroyed. So rape kits are not being tested, and in some facilities have been destroyed, and it's been too long, so they can't be tested anymore. So we've seen that in the state of Minnesota particularly, and I know that there are laws that we're working on to try and change that, but that is not the case currently.
Mr. Chairman, in the areas of criminal law, especially criminal law, I really try to find balance as we write law. And I think from an academic standpoint, one has to ask the question, if this bill became law, could someone be abused by it? A false accusation from many years back, let's say.
Chair Limmer, this bill does not change the standard of evidence that's required for criminal charges and criminal prosecution. So the same standards are still set, and as you stated, the amount of evidence diminishes over time. And so again, this is really about how do survivors heal, and if we can contribute our voices and our stories to serial sex offender cases. But for the most part, we recognize that it is more challenging. However, the balance that exists when any person reports will continue to exist when they report even decades later.
Senator Lentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the author of the Child Victims Act, it was a pretty significant change. And one of the reasons it was passed was because when you have child victims, they have a much greater tendency to repress the memory of the incident and under a lot greater pressure not to say anything for institutional reasons as well. So I don't know that we can necessarily compare that situation with this situation that's being proposed here. I also don't think it's appropriate to compare civil remedies with potential prison time as a consequence if there is a reported act that results in a conviction. It's one thing to try to defend against a civil accusation, and the burden of proof on the plaintiff is lower, but the consequences are also much less serious. It's a whole other thing to be faced with 10, 15, 20 years of prison time based upon what could be very, very old evidence. It's hard enough to defend some of these cases, because a lot of it comes down to he said, she said, and doesn't have the physical evidence as determinative. The physical evidence tends to be, yes, there was sexual conduct, but the question of whether or not there was consent is a whole different issue, and that makes it that much tougher. I would also note, as Chairman Limmer brought up, the issues of defending against false accusations. We did have testimony from the Attorney General's task force, and in their report, they noted that there was a footnote that made reference to the study that identified the incidence of false accusations. Now, I don't by any means intend to suggest that they are common, but the study showed that up to 10 out of 100 or 10% of accusations may be false. So those aren't my numbers. Those are out of the Attorney General's task force report. So it just highlights the importance of being careful in this arena. I agree with Mr. Backus in terms of the interpretation of the existing law. There is no statute of limitations on when this kind of thing could be reported. Now, what law enforcement does with it is a whole other story, and we are taking a lot of steps to try to tackle that problem. And I think that is largely the reason why there are have been such a low, you know, conviction rate or clearance rate or rate of investigation, a lot of other issues going on there. I don't think it has to do so much with whether or not reports are being made to the law enforcement agencies, at least not based on the studies and the media and everything that I've read about. So I'm pretty skeptical about any removing any further statute of limitations issues here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, I mean, a reminder that I think for many people, common sense would say, boy, if somebody can bring forth evidence, then sort of why would there be a statute of limitation in the first place? Recognizing that this could be for any crime if we're just thinking about it just sort of initially with common sense and saying, well, there's a very high standard to prove, of course. As I said before, domestic cases and other cases, well, certainly sexual violence, it's very difficult. It's a very high standard, as it well should be, and as was referenced by Ms. Super, that wouldn't change the standard at all. The reason we have statute of limitations is for finality and have things be settled. But this is a unique crime where the person who experiences it may well experience that lack of finality and lack of settlement for a very long time, and the purpose, and potentially for the rest of her life, and the purpose of the finality and settling is often for the offender, for the defendant, for the suspect. The points that Chair Limmer made about the evidence becoming stale and the distance, et cetera, just a reminder that all that does is make it that much more difficult to prove a charge. It makes it all that much more challenging, all that much less likely that a charge would in fact be brought. But to allow the person who's experienced the crime to have that opportunity to bring that forward, it's true the reference was made for children under 18, but this is something that would apply for victim survivor of any age. To bring that forward and have that opportunity, it seems to me that if it's many years later, it may be essentially maybe almost impossible. Maybe it may be impossible for that charge to be brought forward. But to not have the additional legal hurdle of this statute of limitations, to my mind, makes a great deal of sense. That in this particular case, rather than having the finality and the settling for the offender, for the person who's committed that crime, it seems to me that we don't need to have that sense of finality. That in fact there should be that opportunity, recognizing, and I say this as a prosecutor, it's going to be extremely, extremely difficult, most likely, to prove many, many years later, and such that it may well be that a charge is not brought. But to at least not have an additional legal hurdle for that, to my mind, that makes a lot of sense. So I certainly am supportive of it.
Thank you, Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaking to Representative Pinto's comments this is really for those situations where it's a slam dunk. It's a slam dunk conviction, and the only thing preventing justice is that limitation. And yes, you can do it up to 3 years after it was reported to law enforcement, but the psychology of that is really complicated. Really complicated. And I speak from experience. I was in seminary for 3 years, and there were several creepy priests around. There were. And it took me a while to figure out what the heck was done on one particular occasion. It was an effort at grooming and particularly creepy, but it did not register to me at the time. That filtered in over years. And over those years, I realized what actually was successfully done to some of my classmates at the time. And I guarantee you they weren't in a position, and even if they did report, there's that additional 3 years where the realization filters in and they become a good enough witness for a prosecutor to even consider the bringing of the charge. So I'll admit I have some reservations in situations where consent is not an issue. In a situation like I had another client where more than 36 months age difference, and they get married later, there was sexual contact, and 15 years later they go through a messy divorce and gets reported. One side has to register as a sex offender, and it gives a leg up in the divorce. That could potentially be an issue, of course. Nonetheless, I think for the most part, in most of these cases, Removing these barriers does make sense for situations that it's described. And like I said, it's when it's a slam dunk. The deterioration of the evidence spoken to by Representative Pinto is there, and it only makes the case better for a defendant. In cases where there is no question, there are folks that are looking for justice, and they're finally in the position to get it, and they're barred by the law on that, and I think it makes sense.
Thank you. Senator Lyons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Memories fade over time. I don't think that's just a matter of the ability of the prosecutor to prove a case. But memories fade over time, and people fill in memories sometimes. You don't have to listen to experts on memory reconstruction and so on, but people fill in memories even at our age. We start to think, well, what would I have done in that situation that happened yesterday or 2 days ago? And two different people will come up with exactly opposite memories of what happened even 5 minutes after something happened. I mean, we had an experiment in my law school class during criminal law when a person, it was pre-planned by the professor, but we didn't realize it at the time, barged in the classroom, went off, yelling and screaming and so on for about 5 minutes and then departed. And then we all went around the classroom and we started asking him, seeing the other lawyers' heads nodding, they probably had the same or similar experience, did the person have a beard? Was the person wearing glasses? What color was the shirt? What color were the pants? These are fairly smart people, and we had as many different answers as there were people in the room. So over 5, 10, 15, 20, 40 years, yeah, memories fade. I would like to believe that every prosecutor is going to make the judgment of whether or not to prosecute based entirely on the provability of the case and the evidence that they have before them. But I've been practicing law for 31 years, 25 of that doing criminal defense as well as some prosecution. And I will tell you, there are prosecutors who will bring charges because they feel they need to bring charges, because they feel an obligation to believe an accusation, even if they're going to have great difficulty in proving the case to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law. And there are prosecutors who are going to bring charges because that's the political dynamic going on in their community at the time, or because the family that's involved in the case is a prominent family in the town. I'm not saying every prosecutor does this. I would never make that kind of a statement, but it happens. And the mere fact of an accusation will destroy the life of the accused. It will destroy the life of the accused. And that's not to say that the life of the victims aren't also destroyed by what really happened. But there's a statute of limitations in law for all sorts of things for very important reasons. And I think if we just ignore those reasons, we do so at our peril, and we set very dangerous precedent as well. I mean, the argument Representative Pinto was making could apply to every case, every criminal case, theoretically. Memories fade or whatever the argument is, evidence gets worse. So, let the prosecutors just decide 20, 30, 40 years later if they've got an accusation, they should go ahead and bring the charge if they want to, or if they think they can prove the case. Well, everyone needs some finality at some point as well. And we do live in a constitutional system where due process is paramount. So I know there are probably some people not happy listening to what I'm saying or unhappy with the implications of what I'm saying. But we're here not to do political justice. We're here to do, in our job as legislators, to do constitutional justice to make sure the system is set up so that what's done is constitutional and fair and due process-wise. So I would urge us, I want to hear more about this as we kind of work through our conversations and our discussions, but I think we got to be really, really careful about taking these steps that are proposed here.
Representative Mueller, and then we are going to move on. I did allow a lot of time for this because it is a big idea and proposal. We spent quite a bit of time also in the House having this conversation. It's an important one to have, and I think people on all sides of the issue are bringing very legitimate concerns that need to be wrestled with. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a couple of things. And Senator Latz, I was nodding with the eyewitness identification experiment from law school, but I guess from what we're learning about the brain and how memories are stored, a traumatic experience like sexual assault is a little bit different than sort of that eyewitness experiment. I would also just note, too, with respect to false allegations, we have to be careful when we're talking about the difference between an unsubstantiated claim versus a false accusation. And then finally, I would just say, you know, with respect to sexual assault cases, unlike other types of crimes, and I think our thank you to our survivors for testifying today, and we heard this too from a number of other survivors when we talked about this bill and other bills, is that sexual assault is a crime that silences people. So it's very different from other types of crimes that aren't meant to silence victims like sexual assault is. And so for me, that's a strong reason why I would treat the statute of limitations differently in this type of case than I would in other types of cases.
Very well. Representative Gomez, thank you. Ms. Super, Ms. Mohammed, thank you for being with us throughout the year, wrestling with these issues. Appreciate your advocacy and the thoughtfulness that you bring these proposals before us. Very well. Members, with that, we're going to move on to House File 418. Representative Mueller. 1014.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay. 1014?
Yes, Mr. 1014.
Chair?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Clarifying criminal sexual conduct in the first degree.
Okay, great. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill really arose out of a Supreme Court case that came out in December of 2018, a Minnesota Supreme Court case that essentially held that one act of genital-to-genital contact with a child under the age of 13 is first-degree criminal sexual conduct, but multiple acts couldn't be first-degree criminal sexual contact. So one act could be and multiple acts couldn't be, and that's because of the penetration language that was in the statute. Really, it just highlighted a loophole that we have in our current statute. When we asked for a fiscal analysis of this, the note came back with zero because it says it is assumed that the bill abrogates the case I talked about and restores the statute to the meaning it was generally understood to have before that decision's release date. Accordingly, it is assumed that the bill will not cause an increase in the number of cases, sentences, nor in the penalties imposed. So this is how we'd already been interpreting the law, and really this Supreme Court decision just highlighted that we had a loophole in the language. So while there's no fiscal impact, I guess, you know, I'm new at this, but I would assume that if we don't act to make this change now that and we come back in 2 years from now, we actually will have a fiscal impact because right now there is bed space allotted for how we're currently interpreting the law. We also had bipartisan support in our committee on this bill. Senator Ralph is carrying it in the Senate, and the County Attorneys Association supports it.
Thank you. Are there any questions? It seems like an easy enough fix to unintended consequence of our the way we constructed the law in the past. So thank you for bringing it forward. And then we have, oh, and then we have 418, Representative Mueller.
All right, just shuffling my folders, Mr. Chair.
Yes, creating a CS. See statutory reform working group. I think there is also a reference on the fiscal sheet to that. But we'll find that on page 110 of the bill, and that's in Article 5. Oh, we have a testifier, yes. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just give a quick intro here and then turn it over to my testifier from MnCASA, and I'll let her explain the reason behind this working group. It's a priority for them. It's really something that has arisen out of the Me Too movement, the Deny Justice series. When we're looking at our statutes, we are often coming in and finding loopholes and trying to fix them, and this really is taking a comprehensive look at all of our criminal sexual conduct statutes to determine the best way to actually charge out and prosecute these cases and hold offenders accountable and seek justice for survivors of sexual assault. This working group It has strong bipartisan support, and it's really comprised of experts who are working with these laws and also survivors, just to make sure that we're covering everything that we need to cover here. I'll also point out that the date that it's set to have a report is October 15, 2020, because we felt like this was something that was so comprehensive that it wasn't something that could be done in the interim. We wanted to give this group plenty of time to discuss this. There is a very small fiscal note, and by my approximation, it's 0.00007% of the budget. So it's a very small percentage of our budget, and members, we can't afford to wait to do this, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Price.
Ms. Price, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Bryce. I'm the Law and Policy Director for the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. You've heard from me a number of times this year, and I appreciate and we appreciate all of the attention that issues of sexual assault have seen at the legislature this year and all of the time that you have spent listening to and hearing the voices of victims and survivors. So thank you for that. We have a policy work that is informed. It's really a multidisciplinary process, and it's informed by member programs, allies, criminal justice system professionals, survivors, and many others. We try to do our work in as multidisciplinary a way as possible because we truly believe that bringing a variety of different expertise into the same room and doing our work that way and making our recommendations that way, it's a way of not inadvertently creating unintended consequences. It's a way of really getting the best result and the best recommendation the first time instead of having to fix things later. And an example, this part of this came out, well, I'll step back a little bit. Through that work, you have seen a number of policy proposals and requests from us. Several of those items, well, the repeal of the voluntary relationships statute, which was signed last week, is one example of work that came out of that policy, those policy committees. What we're asking for is the resources and the support to do that on a much broader scale. Our criminal sexual conduct statutes are very complicated. They've been amended many, many, many times. We have sections that are internally inconsistent. Much of it is intertwined. We have multiple definitions of the same things. We have issues between, and Representative Mueller may be able to speak to this detail better than I can, but we have issues with how our penetration versus touch language is in some of the child sexual assault statutes. And what we believe is that it's the most effective and efficient way to tackle this all at once. We really see this as an opportunity for, we've seen bipartisan support in the House. We really see this as an opportunity for the legislature to work together and really, with a very minimal fiscal impact, to really have a substantial impact on victims and survivors and how our system operates. This would be a longer process. We would be coming back to the legislature with recommendations that the working group puts together in order to work with you to get those things passed, to really improve our statutes so that they better serve all Minnesotans. So it's really an opportunity for the legislature to utilize experts across the state to inform your work. And better create amend these statutes so they better serve everybody. The only other thing I would note is we've talked a lot and we've heard a lot within our programs and within our work, and you heard about it in the Denied Justice series of the Star Tribune around the issues around alcohol and other substance related offenses, related sexual assault offenses. And that's one of the segments that we've identified as being problematic in the statute, and one of the things that we would hope that this working group would be able to address.
Very well, thank you. Other questions? Chairman Levin.
Mr. Chair, I would imagine that if we would create this working group then we all are of the consensus that our sexual offender and assault laws are in need of rebuilding. And I'm not sure if we're putting the cart before the horse, because we have changes in our sex offender laws and proposals from both chambers. So I guess that's the first question that we have to ask ourselves. Is it in need of that type of rebuilding through a working group? And then the next question I would have is I see that the working group, the members are going to be picked by the Commissioner of Public Safety. And then as you look through the representatives on this commission will be prosecuting attorneys, city and county, crime victim coalitions, Minnesota Judicial Branch, Board of Public Defense, Department of Public Safety, that goes on and on, then state and local law enforcement agencies and other interested parties. How big is this going to be? There's no limitation to the number, and quite honestly, I think it could very easily be slanted one way or the other without a more definite representation of perhaps prosecutors, law enforcement on one side and defense bar on the other, not to mention victims, but the way I'm looking at this, when it says that the Commissioner of Public Safety is going to pick the individuals in this and then any other interested parties to participate in the working group, and then of those, then he's also supposed to be inclusive of marginalized communities, and I'm looking what part of the marginalized communities can be found in these other groups. And so I just kind of think that this needs a little polish up as far as a fairness doctrine of sorts so that we can have an equal representation on different parties. Am I wrong on this?
So two questions there. Why don't we take the second one first, Representative Mueller, on the composition and the thinking behind the composition of the task force.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Limmer. So as far as the composition goes, this is something that is nonpartisan, and I know I had asked you that question before about task forces and working groups and the feeling that people are going to dig in or it's too one-sided, but this has had broad support, and it isn't like something where people come in to hold their turf and hold their positions. There's an understanding amongst practitioners, I would say defense bar included, that there needs to be an overall look or change at the statute. So I think it's a little bit different than that need where there could be a situation where there's a back and forth going on. As far as marginalized communities, that would really be reflective of some of the victim services organization, the victim advocacy. That was what was really meant by that. So the victim advocacy organizations make sure that marginalized communities are supported. When we first drafted this, we started to draft it as more of a task force. And when we started to list the members, we were feeling like we were maybe excluding people who should be included. And I understand your concern about, is this going to be so unwieldy, so many people involved. And I've really been working with the Office of Justice Program on what this might look like. And, the idea is that some people will be coming in about very specific areas. So, for example, child sexual abuse may not be all of these members, but or adult intoxicated rape cases wouldn't necessarily be all of the members. So there would be, I would imagine, working subgroups within the larger working group making recommendations about specific areas. I've worked with OJP on a restitution working group. I was a legislatively created working group years ago, and we had a lot of members. And that did have more people kind of holding their turf, like you talked about before, but we were able to come up with some really good recommendations, in part because of how well organized they were in really creating those subgroups to look at specific areas. But I'm certainly open to, if you think there would be a better composition, absolutely, we would be open to that. I would imagine the Coalition Against Sexual Assault would support that as well.
And perhaps then, Ms. Price, do you wish to comment on the first part of that question in terms of needs? I think I don't want to put words in your mouth, Chairman, but need for change. What's the understanding going in? The core understanding relative to the review of these statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Absolutely. So this is work that we have been doing on a piecemeal basis, simply because that's the way we've been able to do that for many years. In fact, four of the bills that you have heard this year, the position of authority, which was in Senate File 111, that came very early in the session, and I think I just heard is going to the floor. The repealing the voluntary relationships, removing language that excludes the intentional touching of clothing covering the buttocks, and barring sexual contact by peace officers of folks in custody, constructive or physical custody, restrained. Those are items that all came out of our work. And what we are saying is the way to really do this, there are a whole host of other issues that we've looked at and we've started work on. One of them would be the language around physically helpless or mental incapacitation and how that interacts with how these cases are prosecuted. And there are many, many different areas where the statute has been amended, but only parts of it have been amended, or there are two different definitions of the same thing. There's a section that prosecution simply can't use because the statute is internally inconsistent. And all of that arose from things being amended as we went. One year this would change, another year this would change, and maybe someone would miss that this change impacted this other thing, because the statute is just, that section of statutes is so complicated. I've been working with victims and survivors of sexual and domestic violence for about 20 years, since 2000, so, well, about 15 as an attorney, and then prior to that as an advocate. And I can tell you that I pull out my statute book every single time someone asks me a question about criminal sexual conduct, because it's so complicated that I don't trust, and I see other prosecutors here, you're nodding, it's so complicated that I don't trust my memory of it. I want to double check myself. So there's absolutely work to be done in the statute. And just briefly to address the other piece of your question, I really don't see this as something where there's going to be sort of different factions that dig in. MnCASA sees this work as it's in everyone's best interest to clarify, to be very clear about what should be prosecuted and what shouldn't be prosecuted, and that's good for everybody. I spent some time in a prior role providing technical assistance statewide to anybody working with victims and survivors, and I provided technical assistance to defense attorneys in a few cases who had the same kinds of questions around, you know, does this fit here? Does this not fit here? What's the intent? Why is this so confusing? So I don't see this as a situation where we're going to have people really digging in and taking a side. I see this as a situation where we'd be expanding kind of the multidisciplinary team that MnCASA already, that format that we already use, we'd be expanding that to really address a larger section of statute all at once. I don't know if that answers your question.
Representative Mueller.
Thanks. Just one more point that I was reminded of when you were talking, and sexual contact itself has three different definitions, so I too have to pull out my statute book and look at that every time. But one of the things that's always bothered me as a prosecutor is this distinction we draw between penetration and contact for child victims. So to have to watch a child on a corner house or forensic interview have to describe in excruciating detail to be able, and children don't even have words for these body parts, let alone what's happened to them, and that we sort of force children to talk about it in a way that they don't even understand, in a framework they don't understand, so that it fits into a particular statute, has always sort of bothered me about how that process works. So that's one thing that I'm really looking forward to with the working group addressing on behalf of child victims.
Very well. Any further questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Price, and thank you, Representative Mueller. Representative O'Neill, House File 480, modifying CSC provisions. Members, you'll find that on page 92, and that's in section 5 of the bill. Representative O'Neill, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for having me. So this particular work started as a very large bill, and it started because a classmate of mine got a hold of me. He currently lives in Wisconsin and told me the story of his then 13-year-old daughter, Hannah. And Hannah had lost her mother to cancer a few years ago before this incident happened. It happened to be her mother's birthday, and it was New Year's Eve. So she was the oldest of three kids and was very lonely and was reaching out on Facebook for friends. Now, she came across a gentleman that said he was 19. She said she was 15. And they started a conversation. Now, those of us that know anything about sex trafficking and other things like that, you realize that those conversations are actually grooming conversations because she was 13. He ended up coming to her house from Maplewood to Wisconsin, picked her up, drove her back across state lines, brought her back to Maplewood to his house. Along the way, he picked up another man. Now, he was actually 21, and the other man he picked up was also 21. They gave her alcohol, marijuana, and she believed that her alcohol was spiked because she immediately lost control of her senses. She asked them to please take her back home. They refused, so they kept her against her will. They brought her to a back bedroom, and they raped her repeatedly back and forth for over an hour. By the grace of God, when the sun came up the next day, the man that had taken her from her home returned her to her home. He did say things like, oh, you would be really good at selling yourself. So he was already trying to recruit her into sex trafficking. Forward to the next couple days, and she was acting strangely. Her father asked her what had happened. She finally told him. He brought her to the hospital, brought her clothing. There was an investigation. They found DNA, so there was DNA from both men. They found Facebook messages back and forth between this 13-year-old and 21-year-old. They found outcry witnesses because she had gotten a hold of friends and told them that she had had this horrible encounter and she was in a lot of pain. What they didn't get at the hospital was the full rape kit. They also left a parting gift with her, and they said to her, Hannah, if you tell anybody what happened or tell anyone our names, we will kill your brothers, your two little brothers, your father, and then you. And that's all she had left. Like I said, her mother had recently passed away. So she fabricated the story. She didn't tell the full truth. She didn't tell the full story when the police did ask her. You know, it's an interesting kind of twist of fate because the chief of police at that time was now Commissioner Schnell. And so it happened to be a day she came to testify in front of the House committee, and Commissioner Schnell was in the room and had an opportunity to tell her how hard he had fought for her case, that he had asked John Choi's office, at least on two occasions, I asked him on two other occasions to review the case and to prosecute, and he refused. So, undaunted, I asked John Choi's office to come into my office, and we had a little conversation about the case. And one of the impediments, so my bill, I call it the Hannah Bill, one of the provisions is before you, and it was one of the impediments that John Choi's office pointed out to me, which was the mistake of identity. So right now in statute, if you see it, it starts in line 93.11 on the House language side. Excuse me, 93.13, excuse me. This is specific to third degree and for ages 13 to 16. We have a mistake of identity
mistake of age, excuse me, in statute right now. So if that offender is 10 years older or less, they can say, oh, I thought that that child was 17. And that's exactly what these two 21-year-olds did. They said, well, we thought she was, you know, 17. So he said, why didn't you just eliminate it? Well, we had a little working group, a little conversation. We've had a lot of work on this particular part. And so where we landed, instead of just completely eliminating it for the third degree, is changing it from 10 years older to 36 months older. So you'll see a strike through of 120 replaced with 36 months older. And you can see, too, in the existing statute that the actor must be over 24 months older. So if the victim is between the ages of 13 and 16, the actor must be 24 months older. So this would change it to 36 months older, and then they can, at that point, they could use an affirmative defense of mistake of age, but not beyond that. So that's the first change. If you turn your page, the next change is in the fourth degree. And that is where we did eliminate the mistake of age as a defense completely in the fourth degree. So third degree is penetration, fourth degree is contact. And that is the change primarily that is before you. Like I said, the bill was much more encompassing and we've narrowed it down to these pieces. It also had the statute of limitations change. It had the position of authority change to 120 days. And some of those pieces I think you've already heard. Some other pieces that we put aside that we're hoping that the working group can work on that came out as a big issue when we started looking at the Deny Justice series, and they really did point out a lot of flaws in our current statute. So that is the change before you.
Very well, thank you. Representative, are there questions? Okay. Thank you. And members, for those who were not at our hearing, we actually heard from Hannah directly. She was accompanied by her father. She offered very powerful testimony and was quite moving for the committee members who sat in on that and that testimony. I really appreciate the courage of survivors like her and others like the ones we heard from a few minutes ago. It's important that this legislature be always open and engaging and a good place for those voices to come forward to inform us on how to respond better than we have been responding. So thank you, Representative O'Neill. And Representative O'Neill, my understanding is you're going to also present, oh, perhaps not. Okay. Okay. We do have House File, for some reason I'm not showing it here. House File 745, and that's Representative Herr's bill. She's doing some shuttling back and forth between the hospitals. She's having some tests, and so we're going to try to get her in when she comes back to present that. But thank you for your willingness to do that.
Yes.
As a pinch hitter. So thank you,
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Very well. Then, members, actually, Mr. Chair, I think we're doing pretty good on time here. And we're going to move on to police professional development investment. And we have... we have several bills here, seven bills before us. I think we can get those in before the Senate needs to move to their caucus meetings. I just want members to know that the bill that we brought into the omnibus conference for the House has a really strong commitment to effective law enforcement. And we understand that that commitment has is tied in with the public's trust of law enforcement. So the bills that we have before us reflect ways to both build that trust and strengthen the effectiveness of a peace office of our peace officers across the state. As our state grows in diversity and in understanding how our shared stereotypes often impede law enforcement efforts, it's important that state laws and resources help us to grow in understanding and responding to one another with that change of our demographics. So with that, members, we're going to start with Representative Mulder, House File 327, requiring law enforcement to adopt sexual assault case investigation policies. This is found on page 84 in Article 4. Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this, too, is another bill that really arose out of the Denied Justice series. It requires that local law enforcement agencies adopt a model policy for sexual assault investigations. They can adopt the post policy, but at a minimum they must adopt a policy that really addresses some of the things in the post policy. And we did hear testimony from the post board that they have implemented this policy now. Some of the things that are really great about it really stresses a victim-centered approach to investigating sexual assault cases, and it's very trauma-informed about how victims and survivors remember and report sexual assault. There were a lot of groups that worked on this to really help the post board in developing this policy, so this would really just make sure that local law enforcement agencies adopt this or a similar policy.
Very well. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Chairman Levin.
Similar proposal was in a bill that I presented in Senate File 111. It was just passed in Finance Committee today, and it's moving to the floor.
Great.
Very well. And perhaps either counsel or perhaps Mr. Backus might be able to share if there are any differences between those bills that we should be aware of.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, there are differences. I mean, it's the same concept, but there are specific differences, and I don't have a list of them right now. It hasn't passed the Senate yet.
Very well. Any further questions? If not, then we'll move on to House File 627. Representative Pinto is not here. So we'll jump over and wait for him to come back. Article, is it 18 or 19? Article 19, the Forfeiture Task Force. Representative Mulder, we're going to tee you up one last time here.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this task force to look at forfeiture reform arose out of the forfeiture reform law that I believe that you heard in committee and we heard in committee also. So we also heard a lot of the concerns and have a lot of the same concerns that I think that many of you have with the current forfeiture practices in our state. And one of the things that we were hearing, however, from the opponents of the way the law was drafted, the way the forfeiture law was drafted and presented to us, was how it was actually going to be implemented. And I'm happy to answer questions about some of those concerns, if you have those. But I think rather than go through those details, I'll say that what we decided was to hit pause and create this task force to really look at how we can best implement forfeiture reform in the state, what best works for Minnesota, and not like a one-size-fits-all that perhaps other states have, but how we can best do the work here. And that's what arose. This was amended on the floor, this forfeiture task force. And so with that, I'll stand for questions.
Very well. Are there questions? I know that there's been interest in both bodies for a number of years on this issue. So any questions or thoughts? Okay, very well then. We'll move on. Thank you, Representative Mulder. Representative Dean, your timing is perfect. Representative Dean, House File 2367, establishing U visa procedures, found on page 75, and that's in Article 4. Representative Dean.
Senator, Mr. Chair, I'm a representative. Thank you.
Oh, did I call you Senator Dean?
Yes, you did. It's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The section that you're looking at on page 75 relates to the bill regarding U visa certification for victims of crime. And instead of me spending 2-3 minutes sort of talking to the points, I'd actually have a testifier who would probably do a much better job than I would. So I'll turn it over to Daniela Robinson to speak on this.
Good afternoon. My name is Danielle Robinson Briand, and I'm an immigration attorney here in Minnesota. I'm also a member of the American Immigration Law Association. My practice in immigration law is dedicated largely to assisting survivors of domestic violence, sexual violence, and other violent crime. Representative Dean has put together a bill that serves a really important function. Its main objective is to provide a state standard for one of the main requirements that an immigrant criminal crime survivor needs to accomplish in order to legalize their status through the U visa. That is to prove that they were indeed a victim of one of the qualifying crimes, and that the victim assisted in the reporting of the crime, the investigation of it, and or the prosecution of that underlying crime. The way to prove these factual assertions is through a document that's called the law enforcement certification. It's something that was established by federal law in the mid-2000s and is explained through federal regulation. The problem is that there's not a lot of clarity for local and state law enforcement agencies to handle requests for the law enforcement certification. Essentially, it requires the law enforcement agencies to review the underlying record of a criminal investigation and or prosecution and determine whether that victim did in fact provide assistance. The legislation advances the goal of public safety by encouraging often reticent victims to trust law enforcement and follow through with reporting the crimes and assisting the prosecution and investigation. Without a state standard in place, state and local entities are left to make sense of the program through their own internal policy, which has caused a great deal of inconsistency around the state. So House File 2367 tracks the federal law, adopts the same definitions so that there's more clarity for state level actors to receive the requests and complete them for victim survivors of crime. It is also, I'd like to underscore, a kind of legislation that has been implemented in other states, including some in our area. North Dakota has a U visa legislation, Montana, Arkansas, Delaware, and Connecticut. Each of these states has worked hard through their own state campaigns to end sexual violence, sex trafficking, domestic violence, and the perpetration of other kinds of violent crimes against immigrants in their state. That's my testimony for you.
Very well. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Chairman Lieber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I noticed there's no Senate bill on record. Could you tell me, were you having trouble finding an author?
Representative, not Senator Dean. Did I say Senator? No, sure. No, I did. I was trying to stall.
Maybe he can jump over and propose.
Sounds really good, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did speak to a Senate author. I believe it was it introduced in the Senate?
It was introduced back in 2017. Senator Sandy Pappas had introduced a version. And she was willing to do so this session, too, but I think it might have gotten lost in the shuffle of the legislative session.
I just don't have a record of the bill being filed. Representative?
Chair Mariani and Chair Limmer, I think, as mentioned, back in 2017, there was a version of this that was probably 95% similar to what we're looking at. So you may have had the opportunity to hear that back in 17 versus 19.
Yeah, Representative Dean, I actually carried that bill back in 17. I'm trying to remember if we had a hearing here.
There was no hearing. If I was part of that, and there was no hearing that session.
I think, Ms. Robinson-Briand, it seems to me that the it's been a while since I've looked at this issue, but that the issue, well, first of all, you contextualized it as this involving not always but many times victims of sexual assault.
Yes.
Quite frankly, victims of sex trafficking.
Yes.
Which makes sense because of the vulnerability of immigrants, and you know, we know that there's a global sex trafficking network, if you will, of which our nation unfortunately is a part of. So everything we've heard earlier today about the hesitancy of engaging, even without being an immigrant, it becomes more compounded. But it seems to me that the issue on the table here, perhaps this is for Representative Dean as well, really has to do with the expectation that if someone is coming forward, that it's in our best interest that they have a response, and that the bill doesn't say how to respond.
That's correct.
It doesn't create anything other than a response to a request of a local law enforcement to review for the sake of possibly then having federal authorities issue the petition. Or respond positively to the petition, which we as a state cannot do. Only the federal government can do that. So it's really about just getting a response, it seems to me.
You know,
is that my recollection?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean, this is about individuals that are victims of crime feeling like they're in a position that they can actually go to law enforcement and actually cooperate with law enforcement. This certification only certifies that this individual has was a victim of a crime and has cooperated with law enforcement. Ultimately, that's sort of where this begins and ends. And then the federal government takes over from there relative to whether we're talking about proceedings for immigrations and all those other types of things. So this is really putting a statute and standardizing it throughout the whole state. What is the requirements of law enforcement and whether their obligation to meet with those individuals who come forward, who indicate that a crime has been perpetrated upon them and that they are cooperating with law enforcement.
Very well.
And I would just add that,
yeah,
thank you. I would just add that many victims of violent crimes are vulnerable for a whole variety of reasons, and it's sometimes very difficult to turn to law enforcement and participate in the process. So there is a requirement built into the U visa that ensures cooperation with law enforcement through any ensuing investigation and prosecution. So at any time, if the victim unreasonably refuses to cooperate, then the certification can be withdrawn. It doesn't happen very often because most victims at that point trust the process, but this program was created in order to build the trust between communities of immigrants and law enforcement. And I do want to highlight that in Minnesota, there's a substantial degree of violent crime perpetrated against immigrants in the Twin Cities. And both the St. Paul Police Department and the Minneapolis Police Department have received special training on the U visa and are sort of leading the way statewide to help other law enforcement entities understand what the requirements are. So if the underlying crime is not on the federal list, then a person cannot qualify. If it is on the list and they do cooperate, then they get the certification signed. But just to reiterate what Representative Dean is saying, it doesn't guarantee the visa, and that's a main misconception. The Federal Immigration Agency adjudicates all petitions, and the certification is a main requirement, but there are others that need to be complied with.
Very well. All right, well, thank you, Representative Dean, and thank you, Ms. Robinson. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Humphreys.
Thank you.
Representative Howard here? Thank you. Well, why don't we get you, since you're not on the conference committee? I just know that he's up and down. Are you okay? Representative Howard, House File 2460 establishing the Peace Officer Excellence Task Force found on page 85 in Article, we don't know. Possibly Article 4, possibly Article 4. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the conference committee. This bill would create a Peace Officer Excellence Task Force, and its charge would be to study the laws, rules, contracts, and policies that govern the employer-employee relationship between political subdivisions and peace officers. This task force would really bring stakeholders to help us improve the public trust with law enforcement, to raise up the vast majority of peace officers that serve our communities well every single day, and also to take a look at our system, how our system addresses those rare occurrences when an officer does break the public trust in a significant manner. Specifically, a recent state Supreme Court case, City of Richfield versus Law Enforcement Labor Services, drives home an opportunity to study this issue. And the origin of this case came from 2015 when a Richfield officer struck a Somali teenager in the head during a traffic stop, an incident that was caught on video, generating a lot of hurt in our community. The officer failed to report this use of force violation, something that wasn't an isolated incident. The city fired the officer. However, he was reinstated by an arbitrator with a 3-day suspension. The city challenged this ruling and won on the court appeals, but the state Supreme Court held for the arbitrator. And just to briefly read a piece of the ruling that I think is relevant to why we want a task force to take a look at this. It stated, no doubt many observers would find this officer's actions disturbing. Yet the ruling went on to say that the current laws or current system doesn't provide a remedy. And when the public no doubt finds an action disturbing and yet our system doesn't have a way in place to hold that officer accountable, we have an issue that we need to study. This is an isolated incident. There's examples from Duluth to Minneapolis where officers have committed serious breaches of trust but avoided serious consequence. And I do want to point out that these instances are rare. The vast majority of our officers serve our community well every single day, but these rare instances can have an outsized impact in the trust with our community. And that's the genesis for this task force, which would bring a broad spectrum of law enforcement stakeholders together with experience, with input on these issues. And I think it's the right group to contemplate these challenging issues and bring back constructive recommendations to the legislature. And with that, I would turn it over to my testifier.
Good afternoon, Chief. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Potts. I am the Chief of Police in Bloomington, but here today representing the Minnesota Chiefs Association. We support House File 2460, which establishes a Peace Officer Excellence Task Force. In light of some recent cases, Representative Howard just outlined at least two of those We feel that this task force would allow stakeholders to look for ways to improve the current arbitration system. We acknowledge that binding arbitration language exists in all contracts, in all labor contracts in this state. We do not want to undermine or weaken that language. However, we do feel that if this task force is formed, that they could identify ways to improve the current arbitration process. I'd like to note or add that the Minnesota Sheriff's Association also supports this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Lance.
Thank you. Do we know the position of the MPPOA on this?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lance, I do not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lance, I've had conversations about this bill. They would be represented on this task force, but I wouldn't want to speak for the MPPOA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Lance. Any further questions? If not, then thank you, Representative Howard. Thank you, Chief Potts.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Chairman Limmer, before you leave, I noticed that there's no Senate bill in the Senate on this. Is there a reason?
Mr. Chair, there was actually House Bill 2324 was the first version of this bill introduced, and that did have this Senate author. I believe Senator Dietzick and Senator Hall was a co-author on that bill. I will bore you the story on why we had to introduce a clone to move forward with the bill in the committee. The bill does have a Senate author, Senator Dietzick, and then, as I mentioned, Senator Hall was a co-author on the bill.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, that was introduced after first deadline.
Very well. Thank you again, gentlemen. Representative Pinto, that tees you up. And Senate File 620, or House File 627, establishing model policy for eyewitness identification found on page 81, Article 4. Senator,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe for efficiency, I'll just turn things directly over to my testifier, and she can describe them, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Yeah,
focused.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for hearing this bill today, or trying to reconcile it in conference committee in any case.
Identify yourself.
My name is Julie Jonas. I'm the legal director at the Innocence Project of Minnesota. We're here in support of this bill to simply get in place consistent procedures statewide for practices that are already being followed in many areas of the state. I'm here largely because I can tell you that the number one reason for wrongful convictions is mistaken eyewitness identification. We know in about 70% of the exoneration cases that involve DNA testing, the reason for the wrongful conviction was mistaken eyewitness identification. In 42% of those cases, the mistaken eyewitness identification was cross-racial. This is also an important issue for law enforcement because we know in almost half of those DNA exoneration cases, the true perpetrator was actually caught because we could then use the DNA profile to upload it to the national database, find the true perpetrator. Once we identified those true perpetrators, they had committed a number of significant crimes, rapes and homicides, when they should have in fact been in prison for the crime that they were not convicted for in the first place. Again, if we do identifications correctly, we will identify the correct suspects instead of misidentifying the wrong suspect, thereby increasing public safety. It's not just Innocence Projects and law enforcement that are interested in this. Social scientists have been studying it for years and developed an array of best practices for law enforcement. Those best practices have also been adopted and recommended by the National Academy of Sciences. Already in Minnesota, metro law enforcement agencies have adopted these policies. I know the sheriffs have access to this through Lexapro. The BCA has publicly endorsed this policy and a detailed policy on their website, and Post is teaching it to their new officers. Most recently, the Minnesota Supreme Court tasked the Rules of Evidence Committee to look at this issue, and the number one recommendation that came out of that committee that has been adopted by the Supreme Court is that Minnesota adopt statewide policy that follows these recommended practices from the National Academy of Sciences. So this legislation would bring the state into conformity with what so many metro agencies are already doing, and also with the recommendations of the Minnesota Supreme Court, hopefully avoiding wrongful convictions and making sure that we're always getting the correct perpetrators in prison.
Very well. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. I just want to note that this is a real boon to even the prosecution of cases. Obviously, so we want to make sure that we're convicting the right people, right? You make sure to be acquitting those who are innocent of crimes. But even as far as when a perpetrator is properly identified, it can give a jury great confidence to know that the procedure that was followed was one that was accurate, that makes sure to avoid bias, and it gives a lot of confidence then to be able to say this person was in fact identified properly, and you can then convict again if that's appropriate, and then acquit if that's appropriate. Thank you.
And Representative Pennell, my understanding is that there is no cost to this. This provision, is that correct?
There is not. It's been implemented in a number of states, and there's never been a fiscal note attached. There's no cost to this.
Okay, very well. Further questions, Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm fine with the legislation. I think I'm fine with the model policy. My only question or concern is, as we keep saying, the board shall do this, the board shall do that, and there's no fiscal implication to that. How many things can we ask the Post Board to do in a year and still say it's free? This one has a November 1st, 2019 deadline. That's coming up. There are multiple other times within the bill that we ask the Post Board, we don't ask, we tell them to do things. And at some point, if we ask them to do enough free stuff, in an accelerated timeline, it just ain't going to be free anymore, because they're going to need some help getting it done. And so I don't have any concerns about this piece within the bill and this proposal for the policy. My concern is overall, as we keep directing the Post Board to do stuff and then give them a timeline to do it and then say it's going to be free, at some point they're going to need some help.
If I may, I've been following just a little bit of the requirements that are being asked of the Post Board. I would suggest to you that this is the easiest thing that is being asked of them, and frankly, the policy already exists that they are training their officers in, and the BCA has it on their website. They could simply pull that down and use that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I don't disagree with that. I think, I've talked to Mr. Goh from the Post Board, who, we've directed them in the past to engage in rulemaking, and yet there they are again, still hoping to get the budget line item for someone to come in and help them with rulemaking. And So we keep asking them or directing them to do things and then not staffing them to do it and not providing within their budget for them to do it. And this likely is the easiest thing within the bill that we'd be directing the Post Board to do, but it's like the 15th thing within the bill that we ask the Post Board to do. And so I think the challenge is as we move forward, we have to be able to have some reality within the budget constraints and time constraints within there that 100 free things at the end of the day isn't free anymore. There's so much time and there's so much capacity that the Post Board, until we address the real staffing issue there, can do. And, I I think November 1st is, even if it's, I mean, it says, the board shall, in consultation with stakeholders, develop a model policy, articulates best practice. The board shall distribute the policy. So, and then it has all the requirements for the policy. And so, I would push back a little bit and say this is not printing something off a website and putting it on their website. It is more involved in that. Just in this piece, and this is the easiest one. And so I think we should be mindful as we move forward that every time we ask someone to do something that is free, there's still a time component to that, and that adds up. And so just thought I'd throw that out at this point, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sarwas. I'm sure, Chairman Limmer, you're enjoying the House members having a disagreement over their provision here, but it's all fair. And, you know, quite frankly, I don't know that we've requested anything of the Pulse Board this year, certainly nothing that we're not funding. And, in fact, we've got a Pulse Board is facing a half a million dollar deficiency that we move pretty quickly because we do share I think you're concerned that we should have a Pulse Board that is taken care of because it's doing vital work for the state of Minnesota. Any further questions?
Chair.
Chairman Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto, what does law enforcement community think of this bill?
Chairman, you are chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Limmer. I think that there's, I guess I have not heard opposition. I recall that the County Attorney Association was generally supportive. There was a concern, I believe this is correct, there was a concern about the idea that the policy would require these four items as opposed to sort of having them be aspects that we work through in the policy development process. I haven't heard concerns expressed about it, but there may be either folks would express that now, I don't believe that there's, in fact, if anything, I think there's been some support that you're aware of, Ms. Jonas, but if that's
Ms.
okay
Jonas.
With the chair.
I know that I have not been directly involved with these conversations, but another one of our board members, who many of you are familiar with, John Kingry, has been in discussions with members of law enforcement, and it's my understanding they are supportive of this.
I suspect it may be, Mr. Chair, I suspect it may be more accurate to say not in opposition,
yes.
I suspect. But certainly folks should make sure to communicate with us if that's not the case. But I'm not aware of opposition, I will say that. Chair Limmer, and I'll note that as Ms. Jonas pointed out, I think this is an approach that's being taken by most law enforcement agencies. It's set up to be a pretty flexible way. This is not, I think, a case where we're setting out a standard then expecting significant change in law enforcement to meet it. Rather, law enforcement's been making this change, and this is now setting out a standard to say, this is a best practice we want to make sure that 100% of agencies are now adhering to, as opposed to, let's say, 90% of agencies. So, and this is a bill that was carried in the Senate to anticipate if that question is, to make sure we got that one covered.
Very well. Members, we have three bills left. We have 20 minutes before our Senate colleagues need to be at an obligatory meeting. Well, 50 minutes on that side of the room and 20 minutes on this side. Who knows? So with that, thank you, Representative Pinto. We do have Representative Herr's bill, and Representative O'Neill, I think we are going to have we are going to call on you. Representative Herr, as I explained earlier, is shuttling back and forth the hospital with some tests that she needs to participate in and is not being able to get back. So this is House File 745, marriages by minors provisions eliminated, proof of age required. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Herr, send me some notes, so I'm going to read some of her notes, but I would say before I start that I was incredibly supportive of her moving forward with this and took a little bit of a mentoring role and encouraging role for her to move forward. It wasn't an easy thing for her to do. This is a challenge in her community, but She was brave and moved it forward. So her words are, House File 745 seeks to eliminate child marriages and require proof of age in order to legally marry. When we think of child marriages, our first thought is that of an issue in other countries. That's a problem in cultures and ethnic communities, not of our own. The truth is, this happens right here in the United States, right here in Minnesota. And it happens in communities of different cultures, ethnic groups, and racial backgrounds, from different faiths and communities that have lived in this country for many generations. Child marriage happens everywhere. Between 2000 and 2010, approximately 250,000 children were married here in the United States. About 90% of these child marriages were girls married to men old enough that the sexual relationship would have been considered statutory rape. The statistics showing adverse outcomes for these girls are absolutely staggering. Girls who marry as children versus age 21 are 3 times more likely to be beaten by their spouse. They are 31% more likely to live in poverty. They are 50% more likely to drop out of high school. They are 4 times less likely to graduate from college. And they are 70 to 80% at risk of divorce. They also have greater risk of psychiatric disorders. Once they are married, they are many times trapped. It is difficult to find gainful employment. They cannot buy a car, sign a lease, seek a divorce, or do things for themselves outside of the abusive relationship. Domestic abuse shelters cannot accept minors. So the staff at the children's shelters are often inform the parents of the children's location. Girls attempting to leave abusive relationships have nowhere to go. It's important to note that 2 states, Delaware and New Jersey, have already eliminated child marriage, and 9 other states are considering it. Countries such as Sweden, Denmark, the Netherlands, Germany, along with many other developing countries, have already done so. This convention specifies that signatory parties agree to state by law a minimum age to marry. The U.S. is not a signatory of this convention. So there was a convention in 1962 that talked about consent of marriage, and we are not a part of that. We actually are receiving international scorn for our acceptance of child marriage in our own country. When our international stance on is that child marriage relates to human trafficking and to abuse. We cannot make our federal government sign this convention, but we can in Minnesota take a stand on this issue for ourselves. Child marriages were openly accepted a century ago or maybe even a generation ago. Today we know the girls should stay in school. Today we know that young girls having babies have high rates of infant mortality and maternal mortality. We know that these outcomes are not good. She concludes with her own personal story, and for those of us that were on the House floor, it was rather shocking. She talked about she was at a party in the community, at a community event, and an older man came up to her father and asked for her hand in marriage. And although her father considered it, he rejected it. And so her life took a different path. She was able to go to college, get a degree. I believe she has a master's degree, and be incredibly successful. So had it not been for the intervention of her own father, she may have ended up, just as the statistics had pointed out in the earlier part of her presentation. And so that's why she's bringing this bill forward today, and I was very proud to be a co-author with her. I think the time for child marriage should be over.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Thank you for your mentoring of Representative Herr as well. But my understanding is she's working on her doctorate now. So just an amazing human being. Members, are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Libby.
Mr. Chairman, I've kind of wrestled with this issue. It seems like the ability to stop that type of cultural marriage proposal is being addressed by a very broad way to do it. I believe the age of consent is 16. So that would mean that a young person could have sexual relations, consensual sexual relations, with someone of an older age. But we're permitting that, but we are prohibiting them getting married. And so I'm trying to put the balance into this. The other question that I've had in the back of my mind is, are there legitimate reasons for someone that young to get married? Well, maybe as a father, I wouldn't want my children to be married at 16 or 17. But are there some legitimate reasons to get married at that age? Not necessarily with an old person of a particular ethnic cultural requirement or a pursuit, but simply because they're young, they're in love, and they want to start their life together. And perhaps they don't even want to have sexual relations prior to marriage. So I'm trying to understand, or not understand, but I'm trying to weigh these opportunities. Have you had that discussion yourself or had that thought process of, is there a legitimate purpose for a young couple to get married? We do know that historically, back in the old days, people were getting married quite often in their mid and upper teens, and they would stay together throughout a life. That probably is a past that will never get recreated again. But is there a legitimate reason for a young couple to get married?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. So I would point out that statutory rape is from 13 to 16. So we're talking about, so the age that you're concerned about is 17. So 16 is not the age of consent. It's 13 to 16 is considered statutory rape, depending on how much older the person is, depending on if it's first, second, third, fourth, or fifth degree sexual conduct. So I just want to make that clear. So really, we're concerned about a 17-year-old versus an 18-year-old. I think I would go back to the statistics that Representative Herr provided in the testimony, which is where my concerns are so great. The fact that it, you know, we kind of have gone past that era of two 17-year-olds or 17 and 18-year-old getting married and living together for 60 years. Unfortunately, the statistics of what's happening today don't bear that out. So, you know, like I had said, they're three times more likely to be beaten by their spouse if they get married as children. There's an imbalance of power. 31% live in poverty, 50% drop out of high school, and so on. So whether or not there's a legitimate reason for a 17-year-old and a however much older, 18, 25, I don't know how much older that person would be. I suppose there probably could be at some, but, you know, we live in a different era where we expect them to finish high school and to go on. And I was really struck by the statistics when you look at what does happen when you have 16 and 17-year-olds marrying, and they typically are marrying somebody much older.
Chairman Liver. Representative O'Neill, let's assume that the legislature is okay with barring two 17-year-olds from getting married or a 17-year-old to be married to a 19-year-old. Let's just assume we're already past that and that it's illegal to have a marriage of that age group. What's to bar a couple from going to another state that it is allowed, they get married there, and then are we going to recognize that marriage from another state?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure how the statute is, the bill is written, and Mary Mullen looks like she has an answer for that.
And Walsh, counsel, please. Yeah, and I think Representative Pinto might have something to offer as well. Please.
Chair and members, Mary Mullen from House Research Department. The way this bill is drafted, they do account for that. So if you're residents of the state of Minnesota and you leave for the purposes of marrying, you know, counter to what the statute provides, the marriage would not be recognized. If you're not a resident of Minnesota, but you're using the laws of your own state to marry as a minor, then it would be recognized under comedy.
Counsel, what happens if a couple that gets married in another state that allows it and they move into Minnesota, what happens? Is that marriage going to be recognized in the state of Minnesota?
Counsel?
Chair and members, if they were not residents of the state of Minnesota when they got married, the marriage would be recognized here. Most likely.
I guess the question of equal protection clause in the Constitution may be a question of whether or not this law would actually violate it or not. I don't have an answer to that, but even despite the fact that they're a resident of Minnesota, go to another state, get married under the bona fide laws of another state that's recognizing that marriage, I'm having difficulty thinking that this law would stand up. Because it's not a question of citizenship in this state going to another state. It's recognizing the laws of that other state.
Council Mullen.
Chair and members, because these laws are new, there's a new law in Delaware and another new law, they haven't, that issue itself has not come before the courts as far as we know.
Representative Pinto, you had something to offer on this?
Maybe a little bit on this, and then just something back on Senator Limmer's, Chair Limmer's prior comment. I mean, it does seem like, you know, states have, are under a federal system, right? States have extensive powers when it comes to health and safety of residents, et cetera. So I guess it sounds like it has not been tested. My guess is that, in fact, this would be found to be constitutional and be upheld. But I want to go back to Chair Limmer's comment before about the potential conflict between age of consent versus the age of marriage, and just recognizing that of course, that our criminal laws and our civil laws, right, are set up to, they aren't necessarily lined up because we would not want, this is slightly different context, but there's certain behavior that may be wrong but may not be criminal, and behavior that we want to punish as criminal is not necessarily going to be, so it may be that we say, in fact, we're not going to penalize under our criminal laws sexual contact with someone of a certain age, and yet we're also not going to provide the full force of legal sanction of saying that we're going to have that be honored as a marriage. I don't necessarily see that there's a conflict between those two things because they are such different standards and such different societal statements about those two.
Chairman Lover.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember when former Chairwoman Mee Maw of the Senate Judiciary Committee was wrestling with this very issue. And her approach was a very direct threading of the needle in trying to go after the abuse in her community. And she finally had to back off because of the pressure from her community. And it was back then, this goes back quite a few years, but the community was relatively new. The traditions of the former culture they came from was still very fresh. It was still a practice that was practiced. I think it's begun to fade, but nevertheless, it still occurs. And I was in support of her effort to do that. This broader approach I'm wrestling with. I'm thinking of maybe a young couple who's one of the individuals might be going into military service or going overseas, and they want to lock down this marriage relationship. I can see where that couple might be affected. Or maybe they just go to another state, and then what teeth does this law really have? So I'm wrestling with it. Is it better for the common good? I think one could make an argument to that effect. But nevertheless, I'm just trying to see if such a broad approach to solve this problem is the right approach.
Just real quickly, I just point out, of course, there's so much that someone who's 17 in that situation cannot do, right? I mean, they can't smoke, can't drink, a number of other things. And we do apply that broad brush, and it may be that they want to have that. I mean, just to recognize, right, that in fact we've made those statements recognizing that there may be some individual situations that may vary, but it's a societal statement, and in this case, of the importance of this. So, anyway, thank you to both chairs.
Chair Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking of this, what you were saying, Senator Limmer, when you had talked about are there legitimate reasons to get married when you're that young. And when we were talking about the bonding appropriation for the for Fort Snelling, the topic came up last year, the year before, about the chapel down there at Fort Snelling. And I remember the statistic that a bride walked down the aisle of that chapel once every 7 minutes in the days leading up to a major deployment before World War II. And many of those brides were what we would consider to be now child brides, 17 years old. And, you know, back in those days, I think that a lot of folks would have thought that that probably was a good reason, or a legitimate reason. Many of those marriages lasted a long time, many years. My experience in the military has been very different. And I had soldiers, and when I was in command, many of them make the decision to get married prior to enlisting or prior to deploying or mobilizing. It was almost uniformly a really bad idea. The blowback from those bad decisions, I always ended up having to deal with as a commander every time. Now, the military says that very clearly. I mean, you know, as my friend the major across the table knows well, you get more money, okay, in your BAH for more kids, okay, there are some more benefits that you get from being married, and it seems to make sense. But the baby mama drama, as has been called, by some of my other commanders, a drill sergeant, I guess, when I went through. Maybe it didn't happen 60 years ago, I don't know, but I just feel like I've seen it a lot today, and I warn every single soldier of mine to not do it. And none of us are immune to this either. I mean, my wife right now, I made the bold decision to say, okay, well, let's be boyfriend, girlfriend, before I went off to Fort Benning for the first time for 7 months. And I might not have done that had I not been leaving. We all make decisions like that. And in my case, it happened to be, you know, a good decision. But I couldn't help but mention that when I heard you talk about the military piece, because from my experience, at least these days, it's very different.
Members, thank you, Chair Lesh. Members, we have two other bills. One I think we can do in 30 seconds. The other one probably is a good 10-minute. Chairman Limmer is willing to have us hang around a little bit longer. I know you guys are under expectations to be somewhere like right now. But if we can do these two, then there's no need for us to come back later, and we can finish off our agenda. Representative O'Neill, thank you for being with us here today. So members, with that, and I'll be as quick as I can. House File 334, which is my bill, expanding the Pulse Board membership. Members, currently there are 17 members on the Pulse Board, so this would expand it to 19. And it would do that by naming four public members as opposed to the current two. Of the four, two of the members would need to be from Greater Minnesota, so outside of the metro area. And one member is to represent crime victims. And so, quite frankly, members, was it 15 to 17? Okay, I'm sorry. I did the right math, but I had the wrong numbers. So we go from 15 to 17. And members, the idea here is to expand the richness of the conversation on the Pulse Board as it continues to be that presence for licensing and training, and as it contributes to the bigger discussion in our state about enhancing the community police relations. Members, this provision to Representative Surwas's earlier comment is paid for. It's not terribly much. It is on the spreadsheet. I don't have an item, but I think it's something like $7,000 a year. So that's basically it, members. $7,000 a year. Yeah. Questions? All right. Therefore, members, let's move on to the last bill, which is House File 2709. And again, I'll try to be as concise as possible. And it helps that I actually wrote out my thoughts on this one. Members, House File 2709 goes along with the House's commitment to fully fund the police training reimbursement grants. If you look on line 225, the House is proposing to continue the current $6 million a year each year for a $12 million appropriation in the coming fiscal year. By contrast, member, the Senate proposes to cut that figure to $3 million each year. The 2709 also combines with the House's proposal to extend the current sunset. So there's a current sunset on that on that appropriation. It extends it out for one more year. And so that's a cost of $6 million in the tails. And members, neither the executive branch nor the Senate takes that step of extending out the sunset. Now, to the policy of the bill. The bill seeks to evaluate the effectiveness of this state appropriation for training, which otherwise would have been paid for by local taxes. And it makes access to those state training funds conditional on participating in a way to do that evaluation. So there's no mandate for our local law enforcement agencies to participate in this evaluation, but in order to access the investment that the state is making, then that's a condition. Participation is a condition for that. The evaluation process sets up a new and complementary conversation in Minnesota to strengthen police-community relationships. And it does this by requiring the pulling together of existing public information. And members, that's important. We're talking about existing public information that each CLIO across the state already gathers in their respective agency to create a system that can analyze that data to see where police-community relations are being damaged. There are some mechanics that are connected to this, including the use of a high-quality nonprofit entity that has decades of experience setting up similar data frameworks for a variety of state governmental functions. So totally up to speed, professional, and adhering to things like data privacy and auditing requirements. And then there's also a provision to have the data that's being collected that's being drawn into, the existing data that's being drawn into a state place, if you will, to be stored at the BCA. I can tell you very quickly, I've had conversations with DPS, BCA. They have some qualms with that, and so it may be necessary to do something a little bit different with that. Another possibility is the Pulse Board. There are some real technical issues and challenges with doing that currently within the Pulse Board. But back to the policy, creating a system that can analyze the data to see where police community relations are being damaged involves three data sets. One is a requirement to share the NIBRS data. NIBRS data is basically the new framework around data reporting. It stands for National Incident-Based Reporting System that essentially replaces the older Uniform Crime Reporting Program, or UCR, with incident-level reports of criminal offenses as opposed to a summary-based reporting system. So you can see how the field is really moving across the country in terms of being able to tap into incident-level reports as opposed to solely depending on summary-based reporting systems. So that's one set of data. The second set is use of force data that is currently required by the BCA, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And then the third area data sets are discipline reporting data. The bill sets up the ability to have summary data then be available for data query and the ability for law enforcement to query finer data to see how individual departments and officers without naming the officers. In other words, there's an expectation that individual officers will be assigned an anonymous tag, if you will, to see how those are trending in terms of change outcomes in these three areas that I contend, and I think many folks, acknowledge, have been at the crux of damaged police-community relations. Members, Minnesota has a strong best practices data analysis in law enforcement. It's something that we can really be proud of. This adds the ability to analyze the things that most damage police-community relationships to see how we can do that better. And so, members, that very quickly, in a nutshell, is the proposal. And as we move forward, Mr. Chair, as we move these proposals forward for consideration, I think we can have much fuller debate at that time. But again, I just want to make sure for the series of these presentations that we're laying out the concept for members to consider. It's a big step, and so there's certainly a lot here for us to debate and consider. And so with that, I didn't do too bad, 5 minutes, I think, but questions and perhaps some quick reactions. All right, very well. We do have law enforcement representatives here. I will certainly, when I have the gavel, and if this issue is before us, I would certainly work with you, Mr. Chairman, in case we want to have those voices also publicly vocalized at that point.
We'd want to hear.
Very well. With that, members, we're done with the agenda. Perhaps the very quick question for you, Mr. Chair, since you have the gavel, the Senate has the gavel tomorrow, is any indication of whether or not we would be meeting, and if so, what might be agenda items and action items for us to possibly consider tomorrow?
Well, Mr. Chair, again, at least I have not been informed of any movement in our budgets at all. I'm hoping that we might have a breakthrough later today, but that doesn't mean that I know of anything. It just means I'm hopeful. I think we'll have to get back to you later, early evening today, to give you an indication.
I appreciate your getting back to me. The prior time was the stolen time. It's greatly appreciated. Members, it would be my intent to have us back together on Saturday to finish off this agenda, including perhaps to even have a little more conversation about this last piece.
Sure.
If the committee so desires. I'm thinking noon as a gathering time. Senator Latz, I know you've got a very important commitment. That's going to take you out of state, so I want to make sure that we're doing something that works with your timeline.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm anticipating that I will make that commitment take place tomorrow during the day, so I'll be back to start it whenever this committee wishes to start on Saturday.
Very well. So please stay posted, but I'm thinking midday would be a good. That way doesn't cut too terribly into a Saturday.
By starting noon on Saturday, with how long would you anticipate going?
Yeah, I think we're looking at a similar agenda as today. And so today we actually knocked this off in about 3 hours. So four-ish, somewhere near. It's not my intent for us to go late. I think the only other issue, I think, Mr. Chairman, is that we certainly have gotten, and you know, we've been through this drill a number of times. You know, everyone thinks that conference committee members or chairs are like this, you know, exotic, easy, you know. We have our leadership leaning all over us to get certain things done. And so it could well be that we may be, and so you and I can have an offline conversation about how we can move some things. Obviously, that wouldn't be fiscal related, but if there's a possibility for us to exchange some movement forward, particularly around policy, that could take time, but you and I can map that out in the next day or so. Sure. Very well. Thank you to the Senate members for your patience. I know you need to be somewhere. Thank you all. This committee now stands adjourned.